悪いでしょう。
飛べるわよ。信じるもの全て抱きしめて
腐らないでほしい。挨拶に思うほど偽りそうな胸の熱振り払い
事件へ squeeze me
ドゥクドゥクぶつかる駒で生まれたママを愛してる
一人では
Hello, ladies, gentlemen, and beasts. Welcome to Warrior Death Show on a podcast, not a stream for once. We're doing it podcast first, YouTube at some other point when I can be bothered to get round to it. We're here today to do a Christmas special on Macross Delta at long last. Finally, we're going to give it a look. And joining me, I have, as always, no Macross expert and generally swell guy, the Soul Doctor.
I'm electrical voltage, not the regular dosage. Too obsessive compulsive. I'm fucking explosive. Mixed message in a bottle. I left with the postman.
You do realize you've just peaked by saying that. Like, you can only go downhill from here on this podcast. That's it.
I got more.
Oh. Well, save it for the choice moments.
Okay, can do. So happy to be back. It's Christmas and Macross and podcast, like... Very, very happy. Very excited to do this.
Absolutely. I'm so stoked. And I'm stoked especially because joining us again for this podcast is Neil Breen enthusiast and the Dark Web herself, Vaugh Elliott.
Whatever the other dude said. I don't know these people.
Yeah, baby. She's back. The First Lady. Welcome. We missed you!
Hello. I'm really curious why I had to be blindfolded.
Well, you know.
The location of... Our secret closet club that we hung the sign outside of, Walkure World. You can't know where it is.
Okay.
Secret.
Yeah, which is exactly why we put it in, you know, the WC round the back of a McDonald's. Completely inconspicuous. No one will ever see it.
The E in Walkure is backwards. It's crayon written. Very shoddy.
Absolutely atrocious. So, yes indeed, we're here today to talk shop about Macross Delta, a series I've wanted to talk about for a while, because Doc, being, you know, to me as, you know, the local dealer is to a drug addict, decided to get me hooked on Macross, and now I just, like, it's the best thing ever. I love it.
But then I didn't watch Delta for years.
Well, this is the thing, a good drug dealer never samples too much of his own products.
That's right, you don't get high on your own supply, so...
Yeah, yeah. That's right, you're selling it, you're not consuming it. But finally, you took a dip, you know, you got a little line, you go in, you got your credit card, chopped up a little bit, and you took a good long snort.
And then no one heard from me for 2 weeks.
This is true. This is absolutely true.
Because I'm in my apartment and all the lights are off and I'm just out of it.
Just completely naked, like...
Man, I mentioned Neil Breen before and now I'm just thinking Doc, like, ending up in his own version of a Neil Breen film.
I've got to sample some of this.
No. We watched Fateful Findings, right?
I was given paranormal powers as a child.
I've hacked into just about all the information I need. They have no idea.
No more books!
You remember the scene where Neil Breen is like in the black plastic bag room? He's completely naked. That's like Doc with like Macross Delta in front of him.
Yeah, that's after he wakes up after watching the final episode.
Listen, I'm okay with that. Let me just put this disclaimer out here right at the front of this. Okay, so I
am wearing clothes right now.
Yeah. No, actually, that's not true. No, it is true. But what is also true is I'm glad that you're hosting this because, like, I stayed up incredibly late into the night finishing this show because I procrastinated. And so I'm very tired, but I'm also very, very close to this show. I just came off of it a few hours ago. I'm in that phase of, like, okay, no haters allowed. You can come at me if you have fucking nuanced, you know, compliment sandwiched opinions, criticisms about this show, but if you want to hate on it, just get the fuck out. Like, stay away from my babies. I am in protect mode.
Can I just say that up until the point that you said, like, you know, come at me with opinions, the words you were saying, like, you know, about how you're just coming down from it, I really thought you still were referring to drugs. I could literally cut in, like, the words cocaine or, you know, angel dust binge, and it would fit perfectly with the language you used.
I'm drug-free, except for taurine. That is pumping through the veins at the minute.
That's fine. Now, I mean, coming from me here, you know, the man who's always drinking booze on every live stream we do, so mm-hmm. Hey, there we are. I'm in no place to, you know, cast aspersions.
Seriously, I'm going to be at my most, like, raving, irrational, blind love, because it's Macross for one, and a thing is I love, and spoilers, I really fucking loved Macross Delta TV a lot. A lot.
Yeah, so we have all the players assembled, and, you know, we're all maybe a bit, you know, out of it a little bit in our own little ways. I mean, like I say, you know, Doc's just, you know, he's going to be heading up to Macross Anonymous next week.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, burning pictures Shoji Kawamori, you know, has to be fun. Gotta get him out of your life.
They're just going to be, like, muttering stuff about Mirage and how she was unfinished.
You just black out, wake up to find yourself, like, half naked in front, like, ringing his doorbell. It's like, more!
You just hear, like, you hear from my apartment, like, get out of shitty Gerwalk mode! Get out of Gerwalk mode! It's fucking sucks! Why do you do it?
It is fucking sucks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I agree with you.
That's Ori's really working out for you there. We're going to break up into a couple of parts we have done with our previous podcast. We're going to give you a bit of an overview, then we do spoiler-free, and then we're going to go into probably the most excessively long, like, you know, screaming, ranting, you know, holy shit, this was incredible, or, oh my god, I hated it, like, screed for about 5 hours.
Your phone may get a bit sticky.
Did you? Well, I know mine did, that's for sure. Especially after watching the final episode.
Gushing.
Phone, woofed. I had to pay so woofed. Much to clear my entire room. What the hell?
So, Doc, would you be willing to tell us a little bit about the history of Macross as a franchise?
Macross is the 36-year-old anime franchise. Well, it began as an anime franchise. Now it's become very much a cross-media deal with games and touring concerts and all kinds of other stuff. But the bread and butter of all things Macross are the anime series that began in 82 with Super Dimension Fortress Macross, made by Studio Nue and Artland and Big West. So Studio Nue is where key figure for the Macross franchise Shoji Kawamori comes into things. He's credited as producer for the original series, and Nobuo Ishiguro from Studio Artland, that's his studio, is the director of the original show, which I think a lot of people, like, tend to forget over time. And I think I might have mentioned this when we did our Frontier cast, but some people are like, ah, Nobuo Ishiguro, director of very dry television, like Legend of the Galactic Heroes. And I'm like,
oh, God.
Look, man.
No, I mean, that's a good show, but, like, I was actually thinking of Legend of the Galactic Heroes when you were talking about SDF, and I was like, man, those shows, like, conceptually could have just a little bit in common. Like, oh, right, there we are.
Yeah, similar origin place.
We don't have ketchup and mayo characters in them, sadly, though.
No, it's true. But yeah, same director, right? For the and people are like, ah, Ishiguro, very boring. But, like, he directed Orgus and Macross. So, like, the dude can at least oversee some some interesting, spicy projects. And Macross was a huge deal. SDF Macross spawned the film a couple years later, I want to say. It's 84? I could be wrong about that. Do You Remember Love?
I don't. I'm sorry, I don't remember.
You should.
That film.
You should. Macross, Do You Remember Love? It's an incredible film. It's very easily findable on places like YouTube. And it is a sort of recap of the first series. And I think Do You Remember Love might be the thing that's been English translated subtitled the most times in anime, I mean.
So some people did remember Love then. They remembered it so many times, they did it like, yeah, that joke.
Indeed. there's now, you've exceeded the quota of dear old jokes. There have been several other, you know, Macross shows over the years. It seems like they're more frequent in the last decade or so than they were in the 80s and 90s. You know, we've done our podcast on Macross Frontier and all things Frontier. So if you'd like to hear what we have to say about that amazing television show, also two movies, check that out. It's our fourth episode of Watery Death Show. And then in 2016, we have, let me open the correct tab. Where did you go? 2016. Macross Delta was born, the newest iteration of the Macross franchise, made by, once again, Studio Nue, and Satellite this time. Satellite is the anime studio which Shoji Kawamori helped create, so he's in it via Nue and also Satellite. He's the senior managing director for Satellite, and Satellite known for things like Symphogear and for Aquarion, another thing which Kawamori directs. That's another Shoji Kawamori robot show, if you're interested in Shoji Kawamori robot shows. And in Frontier, as well as in Delta TV, Kawamori sort of, how do I say it? He's the chief director. So he's sort of...
The showrunner?
Well, no, so he has like main creative oversight. And I don't know if this might be sort of analogous to what showrunner is in the States, but he's the chief director. Like, it's his kind of series concept, and he, you know, has final say-so on everything. But the actual on-the-ground director of the show, as you know, and not just, like, episode director, but, like, there's a chief director, and then there's a project director of the whole thing. And... the Delta TV show was directed by Kenji Yasuda, who, if you take a look at his resume, has been involved with plenty of other Kawamori projects, like the aforementioned Aquarion, Aquarion Evol, AKB48, which is one of the, I want to say one of Satellite's earlier works. And when that came out, I remember people being like, what is this? And then watching it and going, oh, this is just more Macross Frontier. This is cool. And yeah, AKB48. Shout outs to Isaac. I bless all. Big fan of both Macross Delta and AKB48.
Can I just say that AKB48 sounds like a banned food coloring?
It does. It sounds like this medicine contains AKB48 dye.
Yeah. AKB48 is not recommended for those expecting, you know, a child. You know, those who are breastfeeding, those who have mind deficiencies,
exactly,
may result in halitosis, psychosis, and possible death. Consult a docs before using.
So he also directed a show called, I'm not sure if you pronounce it Noeen or Noeen. It's N-O-E-I-N. Noeen/Noeen. To Your Other Self. Which, I remember when I was first getting into anime, that show was sort of like a sleeper hit. Cult phenomenon, perhaps, but it's largely forgotten today. That might be worth a look, though. And Delta was written, the man in charge of scripts and screenplays, Toshizo Nomoto. He's worked on the second season of AKB48. He's done some scripts for excellent TV shows like Durarara. He's done he's worked on Kuroko's Basketball, popular sports anime. So he's credited as series composition for both seasons of Log Horizon, which is a very popular, like, MMO. It's sort of like if Sword Art Online were, like, good and not with the real world shenanigans, is what I've heard. That it all takes place inside the game, and so...
Well, it's not hard to be better than Sword Art Online.
That's true.
That's a low bar to clear.
He's written a couple episodes of Iron-Blooded Orphans. So, like, just a ton of writing credits, both in terms of writing individual scripts for episodes and entire, like, you know, being credited with series composition. I'm not sure, you know, saying series composer makes it seem like he's a writing music. That's not correct. So I have to, like, we have Majiro and Masahiro Shindo adapting the character designs for Delta. And they've worked on things like My Teen Romantic Comedy Snafu and Persona 4 Golden the Animation.
Oh, you were doing all right until you said the golden one. I'm like, oh.
Well, just in terms of character designs, not the writing. The designs are...
Well, even then, like, the character designs already exist because there was another...
Well, but they still have to be... Well, they still have to be adapted for the different medium, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing. These are just character adapters. The original designs are Chisato Mita.
Like USB to USB-C. To micro USB.
Right.
Oh, man.
And a person called Hidetaka Tenjin is credited as, quote, Macross visual artist. And
aren't
I'm not entirely
all
sure
in
sort of
anime
what that
visual.
Means.
Except for, like, music or something. But don't they have tons of visual artists? Because they're all visual. What does that mean exactly?
No, I assume it's like, stuff like fashion design and okay. architecture and things like that, which is extremely well-defined in Delta, as in other Macross shows. Like, it's a thing that I quite like about this franchise, is those kind of details. But if I'm wrong, like, Gwen Campbell would know, and others listening possibly, like, please set me straight on what this means. And also interesting to know, I don't have, like, all the seiyuu in front of me. So, Shadon, if you want any of the seiyuu shouted out and credited specifically,
mm-hmm.
get on opening my anime list. But I did want to mention Minori Suzuki, because I find this incredibly meta, right? She is the singer and voice actor of Freya, the leading lady of Macross Delta. And to fill this role, it wasn't one of those things where they had picked out someone beforehand and they just sort of got the role. It was a very particular kind of audition. When she was 18, she won a Macross singer audition from Aichi Prefecture. And she, you know, she was in that big competition. Sort
in
of like,
show.
You know, Freya in the show.
Whoa. Stop right there. You're gonna blow your fucking top when I tell you this, Doc. Have a guess who?
Oh my God! Is
Hayase's
it Phantom
voice actor is?
Requiem from the Phantom Phantom.
No! Shut up! No! Don't do. Fuck! No, Doc. I'm freaking out here.
Is it? Hyoketsu no Judgeness.
No.
Is it Ash Lynx?
Yes!
Yeah!
It is!
My ears do not fail me. Fucking A.
Holy shit. Like, I was just literally looking, I was like, wait a minute. Where have I heard Yuma, like, where have I heard, like, Yuma Uchida's name before?
Mm-hmm.
Rings a bell.
So what is that?
He's the main character in the Banana Fish anime.
Yes.
just hearing the term Banana Fish for the first time, it just can't help but, like, react to it. Like, what is it? Okay, never mind.
That's a thing. It's not important. We don't talk about banana fish. Fuck that. Yeah, that caught me by surprise. So yeah, he voices two great characters. That's a good start.
He does. And but Miss Suzuki, Minori Suzuki, did win the role to be Freya Vion. The sort of, well, it doesn't start out as the lead vocalist or anything, but a key member of Macross's first idol group. Valkyrie, like Macross before, has definitely been about idol singers, as we'll talk about kind of the key ingredients of a Macross show that have that have been in place all these years. But, you know, it's had its idol singers. In the first show, you had Lin-Min-May, the lone idol. And in Macross 7, you had a rock and roll band, Firebomber. And then you had two competing solo idols in Frontier and Ranka Lee and Cheryl Gnome.
Mm-hmm.
But now, kind of the big thing in Japan is idol groups. And so, and Macross is, well, nothing if not a reflection of things that are popular in anime. And so, idol group. We have Valkyrie, and I must say it's an extremely good change because I fucking loved Valkyrie as characters and as, you know, just musically. They were awesome.
Before we go any further, I need to point out something else that's also blowing my mind. So I'm looking at my anime list. I'm looking specifically at Ame Koshimizu. I'm so sorry, I probably butchered that. She is the voice actress of Mikumo. And I'm just here again, like, you know, scrolling down, going doo 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 doo. What?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. She's Ryoko, baby.
Wait, no, she is? I didn't even know that. I missed that because I spotted two of
Darling and the Franks.
Yes. She apparently, this cannot be true, but apparently it is. Maybe voices.
Did you say Ami Koshimizu?
Again, this is because I butchered the pronunciation.
It's Ami Koshimizu, right?
Yes. I think
Ami.
So.
Yeah, she's Ami, she's totally.
Oh my god!
Ami Koshimizu!
Oh shit, she is Ryuko, yeah, she's, you're right.
Yeah, she's Ryuko. She's like, I didn't know she was Mikumo. Like that, she's got a lot of more range than I thought, because I was like, after hearing her as Ryuko, I was like, this lady is like born to play rough and tumble, like badass delinquent chicks.
Sorry.
She rules as that.
She's also Rock Howard in The King of Fighters Destiny. What the
bullshit?
What? What? Bullshit. No, stop it.
I just scrolled
down. Stop fucking around.
It says Rock Howard.
Right, control left, Rock Howard, let's go.
I'm doing that as well. You liar.
0 out of 0 results.
The cheese Rock Howard as child.
Oh right.
Oh, okay.
Wait. There's more.
Howard, comma Rock. You search for the wrong thing. Just search Howard.
I search for Rock.
Okay. Search for Undertaker.
Right, guys. I've got to say this. The more I look at her profile, I'm beginning to think that she is like the nexus of all Warrior Desho like projects that we've ever done.
Oh man.
No, I'm serious. So first off, from the top,
Yukiko.
Yes, she was Yukiko in the Persona animation. She was apparently Hero in Darling in the Franxx, which I find to be utterly
wait a minute
impossible.
Wait.
No, I'm serious.
Wait a minute.
And Naomi.
You're kidding
as well.
Me.
No, I'm serious.
Oh, she's like little kid Hero.
She's young Hero. It just says Hero main. Like, I don't know.
On Wikipedia, it has young Hero.
That's fine. I'll take that.
Yeah, and she was Naomi / code 703.
Fair enough.
Right.
She was also Miki Kuroda in Devil
Miko!
Manga. Yes.
Miki Kuroda!
Yeah.
That's, I'm telling you, like, rough and tumble badass ladies.
Yeah.
Fucking A.
Lastly, right at the bottom when I saw it, she was also Mio in Phantom.
Oh my god. No. No way.
I'm serious.
Stop.
Did I miss
it?
That?
No.
Did I find Rock Howard but miss Mio in fucking...
I'm serious.
Okay.
Oh fuck, there's more further below. Holy shit. Oh my god. Mio was the dog lady.
Who is
right?
Mio again?
She's the one with the dog.
Wait, what? No, you're
in No. Okay. What the?
She was Mio.
Who is she?
The
fuck is this
the
character?
The well-endowed lady.
No. Mio in Phantom was like the girl that
That's Claudia.
Ryuji. What the fuck is his name? Reiji. Where is his name?
Reiji.
Yeah, the girl that Reiji like had a thing for, like in the high school section. Like the
was
second,
that
like,
was that like in the. Like a theme, sort of the festival where they all. Oh fuck! That was Elfin Lied. Oh my god!
No! Never mind. You can't mix up.
Melding the two shows.
No, Mio was the schoolgirl who had a thing of her age when like he and Ayn were like undercover, like after fleeing the country.
Okay,
the
so
one that
so
Cal
more...
kidnapped.
Okay, More notably for me, like Ushiro Miya Rosa from Sea Cats. Another parallel, but from Sea Cats, of course, which is definitely a character I've been like very impressed by the voice acting. What the hell?
Totally.
I'm not joking.
So in other words, this lady who voices Mikumo, like Mikumo becomes like the, you know, the nexus for it all, consciousnesses merge, and she's practically that in terms of voice acting for us as a podcast as well. I'm absolutely stunned at the list I've been reading here. That's blown me the fuck away. Holy shit.
It's pretty incredible.
Aye. But she's great. Like, starring some shit though she may have done, such as Phantom, she's still fantastic, so...
I mean, it's a living. It's a job.
This is true.
It's a job.
pays the bills and puts the foods on the table. Okay, so, a couple of quick things to talk about, I suppose. Amiko Shimizu voices Mikumo, but Mikumo actually, the singing part is done by someone else. And that is Juna, who is a, as I understand it, quite a popular pop singer, solo singer, like Mayan, who voices on Main Army, pronounced, who voices Cheryl.
Yeah, Cheryl.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Similar press. Also, again, because, you know, everything is connected, if you watched Ancient Mage's Bride, the first OP of that season was sung by Juna, as it happens.
There it is. Mm. Oh my gosh.
Mm.
Yep, second OP of that season was voiced by Mayan. It all links. Everything is linked. Everything is connected. It's ridiculous.
Even our minds are smushed together by Royd.
Did you watch Ancient, like, for the show? Or?
Yeah, I did. I discussed it with Danny, Kay, and Bethany.
This was he was on someone else's, he was on the anime's lip pod.
He didn't keep his promise. He tricked me, and I don't care anymore.
Cheater.
I'm sorry.
You eat the pumpkin.
Mm. So, one thing that I think it should be stressed here is that when we talk about Valkyrie, like, yes, they were created as characters for a show, but the bananas thing about Macross is that, like, at least since Frontier, they have indeed been running the actual, like, singers in parallel to sing the songs from the show, and Valkyrie are still doing concert tours, like, several years yes. after. You'd think that they, like, would burn out as a gimmick, perhaps, if you were to always phrase that way. Not so. I mean, I've seen footage of their concerts, and they are packed. Absolutely packed to the brim.
Next year
is the big one,
the crossover where all the singers from all the Macross franchises over these 36 years are going to do a big show.
Yep, Macross crossover,
very exciting.
One final thing about the voice actors, by the way, Bogue or Boog or Bourgeois or whatever you want to call him,
Bourgeois,
yes, yeah. Bogue is voiced by Ken.
From Street Fighter?
No, just Kate. No, that's the name that's listed. Ken, K-double-N.
Yeah, I think it's more like June, which was like, it's basically, in all capitals, it's basically like an artist name. Like Madonna.
Who's your voice actress?
Hey Ryu, I got a tryout to be a voice actor. Come with me to the studio.
Wave punch!
Oh, fuck. Okay, so that's the franchise as a whole. Very brief, like, we've not really mentioned, like, Macross 7 or you know, Macross Zero, the Truth in Advertising edition.
Oh, there's a reason we didn't mention that, or Macross 2.
Well, to be fair, it's so bad that Dels doesn't mention it despite giving lots of lip service to the various other shows.
There's a Macross thing that's bad?
Yes.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's one. It was only, it's only a 4-episode thing, so it's kind of easily forgettable. They did make the main plot of it into an episodic plot in Frontier.
Oh, 2002.
Woof. The CG is woof. Oh.
Yeah, the zero in Macross Zero is the Metacritic score we get released today.
You know what
was
released in 2002? Yeah, because it's that era. It's Elfin Lied, the manga.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, that 2002 was a cursed year, wasn't it? Really was. So, let's quickly talk individually about what we know about Macross per se. What have we seen, what have we experienced? Because here's the thing about Delta as a show. I watched Frontier, having only ever watched Plus, and the thing is, Frontier, for the most part, pretty much stood alone. Like, it referenced its previous installments, you know, in the franchise, but otherwise, you didn't really need to know a whole lot to get behind what was going on.
Yeah, the references are more like kind of contextualizing the history of certain things, rather than kind of like...
Yeah.
Well, so, in Frontier specifically, there are a ton of homages, but you don't, like, it's homage done right in that you're not lost. Like, you were, as you say, you were perfectly able to feel what the characters were feeling, get behind them, understand what was going on, and, but there's just this other layer of engagement for longtime fans, like, oh, like, they're playing off of this trope or that trope, or they're redoing this plot, you know, and... it is really an excellent homage.
Like, oh shit, this is like what Bando did to that lady. Oh my god. I understand this.
Oh, no.
This is the beach cleaning redone for the 21st century.
I like to imagine that Bando has a cameo in Delta cleaning the beaches at Ragnar. That would be something.
Another jellyfish!
Ah! Yeah,
he would shoot it with my revolver,
and he wouldn't hit it. He wouldn't even hit it once.
Okay, no. Well, let's discuss a very important topic. Would Bando catch that cat faster than Hayate?
No. Of course he would. Of course he wouldn't.
Just ruin the audio.
No, the difference between Bando and Hayate and Cohen trying to catch that cat is that Hayate and Cohen gave up. Bando would be doing it for days on end and nights. So he would never give up.
Nothing if not persistent.
He would be buying sea mines and dropping them in the fucking peaks together. Alright, okay. So, references Self and Lead aside, the reason I'm bringing this up is because Delta does indeed have a lot of homages, but there is also a lot of continuity at play here. The main events of Delta, spoilers ahead, are indeed the result of the events of Frontier. And in a way that I feel this might have been a little lost on me versus, say, it was for Doc, one character in particular, their character arc, quote-unquote, unfortunately, was kind of lost on me because people put a lot of emphasis on that person's ancestry. And that ancestry is something that is revealed if you have happened to have watched Macross 7. I haven't, but Doc has.
Well, and the first one as well. Her grandparents are major players in SDF.
Ah, right, okay. So, yeah, so in that character's particular case, it is one of those things where you will, objectively, I would argue, be worse off going in having not seen the previous installments.
Yeah, that's a good point, because, like, I can see, like, I just wasn't thinking about sort of you guys' point of view when encountering this character, and for me it was like, oh man, she's this person's niece, this person's granddaughter. Oh my god, this is amazing. I'm so behind this character already.
I encountered this person without having watched, like, basically any Macross before this, and I think they still got parts of the arc through quite well, since they had already kind of established, you know, the conflict between spoilers and spoilers. And... they very easily showed the kind of tendency of, like, different kinds of people not being friendly with each other.
This is true.
So it's like, when you draw a parallel to, like, okay, it was a worse time. I've seen some of Frontier, which was significantly more apocalyptic. But, like, you know, so with that context, you know, it was a worse time and it was, like, a huge crime back then. You're kind of led to... I think it explains the backstory pretty well. I wouldn't say you kind of need to watch it to get the full experience.
Oh, no. Oh no. I'm not saying that you need to watch the whole thing, but I'm saying that it's one of those instances where viewing the previous entries is still very much optional, but I would also argue it is recommended. At least with regards to that particular character.
Only with... In terms of spoilers.
Yeah.
When you're thinking about spoilers.
So that's why I'm just bringing this up now, because as we discuss the characters later on, particularly that one, and also the events of the previous shows, I think it's just important we establish our credentials that way.
Can we just say her name? I don't know why we're not saying it. It's Mirage. We're talking it's about Mirage Farina Genius.
Corporal Lieutenant Commander Myrage.
That sounds like an Inferno Cop character. Alright, so for myself, I have seen Macross Plus the movie, and I've seen Frontier, and that's it, because unfortunately I'm an idiot who doesn't recognise a good thing right in front of him and really should watch the others. So I have at least seen Frontier, which is the direct, like, you know, antecedent of this particular show. Like, so that's something. Vog, you mentioned that you've seen parts of Frontier, is that correct?
I've seen the movie.
The movie or both movies?
Both movies. I thought they were one movie because I watched them back to back.
Cool.
Arguably they should
They might
been.
As well be.
They might as well be.
Yeah.
But from what I recall, wasn't it mostly like just kind of the first few episodes of the show kind of summarized or something?
No, it was the whole show.
It was like, the whole thing. Okay.
Yeah, it was like, well, so they kind of recapped the first half largely, but then the second movie was an entirely new direction that the story went in.
Yeah.
So if you watch the TV show, you'll notice, like, in the front half, like, some of the same shots and similar things happening in the story. As it goes along, they start to deviate a little bit, and then the second half is totally
different. Oh, so it's completely
different.
Okay, that's why I didn't remember the spoilers that did happen that are mentioned in this.
Oh, yeah, and I've seen all the Macroy, whatever the plural of Macross is.
You said it. You just said it.
Macroy. Macriscos, you know? It will make you jump. So...
Oh, goodness.
I know. That's pretty bad. I'm sorry. Okay, so what exactly is Macross Stellar about? Well, I think it's important that if you're not familiar with the franchise, we introduce what you've described in the past, Doc, as the three pillars of Macross, which are like the three main ingredients. It's like, you know, every pizza at least has to have a base, a sauce, and a topping. And, well, it's kind of a similar principle here. Three pillars of Macross. First off, pop music. Second, transforming fighter jets that also serve as humanoid mechs.
Yeah.
And three, love triangles. Things that you otherwise wouldn't expect to smash together. I mean, love triangle and pop music, arguably, you'd think might have some sort of interlink, but then also, you know, war and mechs and shit. Not so much, but if there's one thing I can say from the Macross I've seen so far, the three of them, that is, it's free for actually doing them well and mixing together in a way that does not feel like jarring or dissonant, which is ridiculously surprising.
Yeah, in terms of like what happens, there's different things done around them, but those are the sort of like what's the way to describe them? Those are sort of part of the core aesthetic,
the pillars, as we said.
In a way, yeah. Like it wouldn't really feel like a Macross show, right?
Things were. Well, I'm at least very angry about at least one of them, so let's see.
I can imagine which one that is. Okay, so those are the three core ingredients of any Macross show. So that defined, what makes Delta different? Delta's story is essentially one of civil war. It's also one of, you know, past events haunting the present, you know, weighing down on people, warping perspectives and ideologies. We're not going to provide a whole detailed like end-to-end plot story because there's a lot of events to cover. But the best way, I suppose the best place to start is at the beginning, in that 8 years after Frontier, or indeed in the years since then, people in the galaxy of the Macross universe have started to suffer from what's called VAR syndrome, which it is unfortunately as simple as a skin rash or, you know, an unfortunate case of gout. VAR syndrome causes you to turn psychotic and you start killing people.
Is the Umbrella Corporation involved in any way?
I wouldn't put it past it, actually. I mean, Roy does look like a scientist from the Umbrella Corp.
Is it the T-Virus?
Oh!
That's brilliant.
I'm actually genuinely surprised they didn't call it a viral outbreak at any
point. Oh my god.
Yeah, I know. So this unexplained VAR syndrome, like, it's happening, and it can only be cured, or at least alleviated, through music from very specific people who, without getting too technical nitty-gritty, have certain, you know, unique abilities based on a long-standing facet of the Macross universe and mythology, which is something called Fold Quartz.
And what are they called? What's the name of the unit? Tactical Sound Unit Super Dimension Venus Valkyrie. And they always look like they're insulting you with their fingers.
Oh my god, yes, you know, they have the special powers, but they've also all must have been genetically modified to do the fucking thing with their fingers. I need to find a single person in real life that can do that shit. Like, I can't.
Man. It was either that or, you know, they just call themselves like the Venuses, and in which case it's just the two fingers then. You know, one on each hand.
Call themselves the W. Because they win.
Yeah. That's true. If you happen to be British, you will find the hand gestures remarkably offensive, and indeed there are times when it's just the two fingers on one hand, the double-barreled shotgun, and coming from a character like Freya, who is otherwise, like, really charming, it's actually kind of funny.
It's great. I tweeted that she often looks like she's about to kick someone in the stomach and give them the Stone Cold Stunner. Because she just reminds me of Steve Austin. Just giving the double birds right into your face.
If we have someone who's an animator out there who's also a fan of our show, I will pay you a kidney to make that happen.
I will pay you Shadon's other kidney.
Well, I'm taking your kidney as compensation. Fuck. Then.
I mean, I don't have one. I'll have to borrow it.
Oh, shit.
I mean, I guess I can, like, save, like, if I shave, I can put that in a bag and donate that.
Okay. So, Valkyrie, like, dealing with the VAR syndrome is, well, it isn't just a medical drama, thankfully. There is, it turns out, a reason that the VAR syndrome is happening. And while indeed it is going on, there's also an ongoing civil war between the nuns. Yes, really.
The new UN Spacey.
Sometimes they're called also Nug.
Nug?
Which I find funny
what
as well.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Nug.
The new United Government. The Nug.
Were they the ones that found the ass?
Oh,
yes!
The
yes!
acronyms in this show yes! are fucking terrible!
It's incredible! Incredible!
It's so bad! So
the nuns found the ass.
Yes.
And then space happened.
It's just a porn plot.
It really is. Oh, if you think that there's a scene I'm going to talk about later that is very pornographic in a way that you probably didn't even notice. But anyway.
Before you get too far away from Civil War, I just want to, like, hold my hands up and say I'm a dummy. Because when we did our, and shout outs to you, Shadon, for keeping this under wraps, but when we did our very short for the Macross Speaker podcast for Gwen, what do you want out of the next Macross after Delta? I talked about the Civil War and humanity rather than fighting aliens, and you kept your mouth shut, but I ended up looking super stupid, because it already exists!
It's a thing.
This is it!
It's a thing.
This is it!
It's a thing. So, by the way, I just want to reiterate again, nuns as a acronym, every time I hear the phrase in the show, the nuns are coming, I just burst out into laughter. I'm meant to be frightened or worried about this military force that names itself after female pacifist, excuse me.
So yeah, like the there's fuck? A bunch of yeah, there's like my rage was like, yes, I saw combat when I first enlisted in the nuns. I'm like, what the fuck is that?
Exactly.
Look, if you guys didn't go to Catholic school, nuns are to be feared. They are to be feared
this is true. I did see Machete once. Nuns can be quite dangerous. Not these nuns, though. They're all assholes all the time, permanently. No, that is not a spoiler.
Well, at least they can keep a secret.
This is true. The nuns in Delta are at war with the Kingdom of Windermere. Windermere is a kingdom of humanoid individuals, and as it is not initially made clear, exact specific events that happened to lead Windermere to, you know, go to war with nuns. You see how stupid that sounds, by the way. But yeah, that's the opening premise. And as it turns out, the VAR syndrome and the Civil War are very closely interlinked. And our three heroes, because there is indeed the love triangle, so we've got the guy and the two girls. Two of them, that is to say Hayate and Freya, meet on another planet and end up actually on the planet Al-Shahal. Desert world. It's basically Dune minus the, you know, the Fae Dakin.
It's really a rich place, though. What the hell?
Who can say? But they meet there because they're both drifting. Freya is trying to find her way to go meet Valkyrie for the first time to audition for them. And Hayate is wandering because, well, he's a drifter. He's an aimless bum, pretty much. He's a no good for nothing ragged.
A like whippersnapper.
Scoundrel scallywag. Whippersnapper, not working like I used to back in the days. Right, anyway.
Man, in the beginning, I really did not care for him, but he grew on me very quickly. Just those initial episodes, I was just kind of like, fuck you, dude.
Yeah, so they end up actually getting caught up in the latest fire outbreak on Al-Shahal, which is when Walkyri turn up, along with the Delta Flight, who are their military protectors. Because, as it turns out, Windermere really, like, particularly some individuals in the Windermerian military, really, 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 really want them dead.
Mm-hmm.
One in particular has such a massive hate boner for them, it's actually kind of funny. We'll get to you in a bit, Bogue. Don't you worry. Don't you worry. You'll get your moment in the sunshine. But yeah, after that point, Freya and Hayate end up going to the planet Ragna, where they enlist respectively in Walkyri and Delta Flight. That's where they meet Miraj, who also pops up briefly on Al-Shahal to try and arrest them for reasons and crimes, but who gives a fuck. And after that point, the series then progresses as the war escalates and shit hits every single fan in every single office in every single corner of the galaxy. No surprises, by the way, for guessing that the final battle does happen on Ragna, and then is, you know, up. Is called Operation Ragnarok.
Oh, nice, nice.
Which, I'm so mad it wasn't Ragnarok and Roll, though.
Well, I mean, you know, the Windermerians with their, you know, black airships, it was a very, like, you know, it was a, basically a black onslaught. It was a big, big mistake.
Okay, that's the plot. That's the plot of Delta, at least a starting point of it summed up essentially, without any spoilers.
And it goes places. It goes places.
Freya was trying to get to like a Freya, like always, like singing was trying to get to the Valkyrie audition, but then kind of ran into issues. But what I really enjoyed is that they got the kind of notice me senpai moment out of the way just immediately. Like, they kind of didn't deal with the sort of cliche that's kind of very unsatisfying to watch, where the character kind of, like, fights to be recognized. No, like, her talent is recognized pretty much immediately, and we immediately get to the good stuff. So I think that was pretty good.
I don't mind that particular plot, Fred, when it's executed
of
well,
course.
See Ranker,
of course.
As your obvious comparison point. But I am in absolute agreement with you that the fact that Freya gets that side immediately... and gets underway is quite a refreshing change from the norm, and it allows things to progress. Doesn't help, unfortunately, that Mikimo, the lead singer of Walkyri, is a complete ice bitch, but, well, that's a different topic for in a bit.
Holy fuck, is she a super bitch sometimes. God. By the way, Mikimo, if you're out there listening, call me.
I'm not going to deny that she is quite hot. One thing that Delta addresses very quickly, I think we should probably cover here, is that you might think to yourself, okay, hold on. If Valkyrie singing cures the VAR syndrome, just, well, that's not really a big deal then, because they could just distribute it on MP3 or fucking, I don't know, Spotify. Or whatever Spotify is called in the far distant future of Macro
Stealth. No, but the space bugs are not happy with Spotify.
but as it turns out, Valkyrie actually have to be present in order to, you know, have the desired effects on nearby people. If you just play back an MP3 of it, of one of their songs, it doesn't have the same
effects. It's basically a recording of sound. It's not like kind of the physical, the kind of almost metaphysical effects that this kind of fold thing has. It's like taking picture of food. The smell is not there and you can't have it.
That is such an amazing metaphor. Thank you, Vaughn. Well done. That was excellent.
It was. Also, live music is this superior, right, to recordings? Is that the idea as well?
Yeah. But that being said, that then brings up the fact that they are indeed often in a war zone when they're performing, and indeed are directly attacked on numerous occasions. Mostly by Bo, because again, he's the one with the hate boner, but, well, we'll get to him. So that's why. That's like a thing that they clearly must have, like, addressed when they were writing the show. Like, oh shit, wait, wouldn't this be a thing, like, when they just play it on a fucking MP3 player and it's all good? No, we'll write on that. And that actually makes it better, in my opinion. It makes, you know, the threat more real. Like, you know, because Delta Flight are not just there fighting for the sake of it, they're actually trying to protect Walkyri. And that plays then into Hayate and Freya's own relationship where they're trying to look out for each other.
Although at the same time, at some point, they're singing in an enclosed space, in an enclosed, like, glass cage. and meaning to broadcast this to people through space. So technically there's sound amplification. Technically it's being played through a speaker. You don't want to go there, dude.
Yeah. No, I hear you on that, and we could argue, like, about the mechanics.
I did not care at all. That's not, like, the show is good enough where it's like your brain doesn't even go there. Like, who the fuck cares? They're singing. It's awesome.
Thank you. This should be the biggest endorsement in the world if this lady.
I did not care.
Morgalia, who fixates upon minutiae of the technical variety oftentimes. She's able to just put it aside because it's so enjoyable on its face. Like, that should tell you something.
Yeah. And I will add as well, by the way, that there is a very detailed explanation in episode 19 of the show as to exactly how the VAR syndrome works.
Listen. The super science-y explanations, like, part of the previous shows also. Because, like, I think that's, aside from the garbage, that was, like, one of the least favorite parts, at least for me. A lot of exposition and, like, very kind of technical stuff that I don't think, like, served the plot any much better. It was mostly used to kind of, at least from my understanding, was mostly used to kind of give context to how good people were doing, because you can only make them sing so good, and you can only make the effects so flashy. So you have to have ever-increasing numbers, ever-increasing glowing jewelry, where it's like, holy fuck, now it's like 10 times as good, but it sounds the same. I didn't care about this, by the way. I was totally fine with it. When I say it, my least favorite, it's like, okay, cool. It works. Bye. I love it.
I'm just bringing up to say that even though, like, it doesn't really matter, it does make an attempt to explain that. That scene will be relevant.
You appreciate the effort.
Yeah.
You appreciate the effort.
Yeah. The show, like, that scene also has another meaning, so we'll get to that later, so fuck that. So anyway, would we recommend Delta? Let's do this before we actually get into the spoilerific discussion. I will start. I'm going to say that, firstly, if you've never seen a Macross before, I am actually going to offer a controversial opinion here and say that you should not watch Delta right away. I think that you should at the very least watch Frontier. And I'll tell you why, for two reasons. First off, because of the continuity elements, it does help your enjoyment, I would argue, if you have seen Frontier at the minimum. But two, I'm also not going to pretend that Macross is for everyone. Now, I mentioned before the idea of, you know, the three pillars and how they seem like, you know, chalk and cheese coming together, or, you know, things that don't necessarily mix. For me, I love them all. I think they work really well, and I think they're blended really well to the point where they enhance each other. They all serve a function. They're not just there to be flashy or just because someone thought it'd be cool to put these things in disparately. But I'm also not going to pretend that everyone will like that, you know. It can be a bit Marmite, this kind of show. So try Frontier first. If you like Frontier and watch it all the way through, first off, great choice. Second, you'll then be primed to watch Delta. I'll finish off by saying if you have seen Frontier at the minimum, though, or even all the franchise and in between, absolutely, without hesitation, watch Delta. It is not as good as Frontier, in my opinion. That's probably going to get vegetables thrown at me at some point by someone. But it is damn close, and it, on top of that, does new things that Frontier definitely didn't do. It has its own unique flavouring to it, while still being very Macross. I cannot recommend it enough to people who are already fans of the franchise.
I'm going to completely disagree with Shadon here and say that you should not trust him and that you should unsubscribe from his Patreon. I would argue you don't even
Patreon?
Have to watch the rest of Macross, but it's better if you have, like, a sort of cursory understanding of roughly what it is. Like, roughly that it exists, roughly the characters, roughly what happens. Because, I don't know, Macross Frontier didn't do very much for me. Like, I didn't cry for 2 hours at Macross Frontier. I cried for 2 hours in this thing. So,
it's because you didn't watch the TV show beforehand. That's all I'm saying.
I watched a bit of Macross Frontier, but I think it was pretty incredible, even despite not having, like, watched the real Macross Frontier and the other Macross.
If you haven't seen Macross 2, don't come at me.
Macross 2 Electric Boogaloo?
The very same.
Given the pedigree of the franchise, that's probably the most appropriate use of that joke there's ever been.
It's 100% right.
Exactly, yeah. I will argue that you should watch Macross even though you haven't watched other stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Vorgelia, actually. I totally think, like, for me, this show is pretty damn accessible. Like, they do such a good job of making...
Contextualizing.
Yeah, contextualizing everything and having that continuity. I mean, making this show take place in a timeline that you might not have seen or had access to, but you still can get on the ground floor with these people, these characters, and really, really enjoy it. I think if you watch, you just have to watch the first episode of Delta, like, because I think from beginning to end, it has a lot of what's in that first episode, because you have that amazing, like, pop music is playing while stuff blows up scene, which is sort of like high adrenaline peak Macross. You have a lot of the good character interactions and the great music and the planes. So, like, if you watch the first episode of Delta and you're like, okay, like, I think I'm in. I'm pretty intrigued. Like, it only gets better from there and more interesting and pays off your emotional investment by and large. But yeah, check the first episode. And I think this is a great entry point into Macross. And you may find something like Shadon did with Frontier that you really, really like and want to go back and watch the rest of. Because there's plenty out there and it's mostly all really good.
Yeah. In fact, come to think of it, like, while I still stand by my point, if you did watch Delta first, then that would actually give you incentive, given all of its continuity nods, to go watch the previous installments. So, okay, while I still stand by my point, you can also completely ignore it. I know that sounds like contradictory, Schrodinger's argument there, but there we go.
I mean, when you compare it to, like, the other big, giant, huge, long-running robot show, Gundam, like, you absolutely will not know a lot of things and be worse off if you jump in the middle of one of the modern Gundams that take place in the Universal Century timeline, so much so that, like, they've started doing this thing where a lot of Gundam shows that come out these days, they just put in an alternate universe because they know the continuity is like an albatross around the neck of the franchise for everyone except longtime fans of it. And, I mean, this show's been going almost as long and all of it takes place in the same timeline and it's not burdened at all by the continuity. You could really start anywhere, I think, and be mostly good and get everything with the stories and then come back later when you have watched it all and be like, oh, the references, like, it just enhances your experience. Just to add to my recommendation of the show, because I feel like I've only talked about, like, why you'd want to watch Delta, why you'd be okay watching Delta without watching other Macross, but I didn't really make the case of why you'd want to watch Macross in the first place. So you've heard us talk about, like, you know, fighter planes that turn into robots. Those might be your thing. If you want to watch kind of the journey of an idol group, you know, follows this group of singers that have ups and downs. That's really interesting from a human interest point of view. And if you just want to watch it for, like, the music, you know, you could watch it like you'd watch Moulin Rouge or a musical and just fucking enjoy the amazing pop songs. You could do that also. But I think, like, below all that, like, deep down at the core, there's actually, Shadon alluded to, like, that thematically, this is a bit of, heavy is not the word I want to use, but it's substantive. Like, there's weight. You know, this show talks about dealing with your legacy, with expectations that have been placed upon you for generations, even. And this show questions, like, whether or not you can even choose your own path in life authentically. The show is a really, I think, charming love story. The show is an exercise in excellent world building, in really fleshing out places and making them feel like real cultures that are lived in and that are not really derivative or hacky. And this is an excellent action series with amazing direction, really good fight choreography. I think that there's just a lot in it for everyone. And Macross has always, for me, been this blend of elements that are all executed incredibly well and come mixed together into an excellent cocktail. It's a thing that I think, like, if you're into anime at all, there will be some kind of access point for you in this, and it'll be a good experience for you, and you'll get really good things out of it. I really do think Delta pays off what you put into it. I really do.
Hmm. Indeed.
So the scientific argument that we're going for is Cheryl, bad waifu, silent hacker, winner of stuff.
That's an argument I would half agree with.
Can't we like both? Why do we have to?
I am joking. I am joking.
I know.
Whatever.
Oh man, push it.
I think Cheryl at least didn't have nearly as much character as like a single person in the group. At least in this anime, but maybe I watched the movie.
Go back and I would say to get the full Cheryl Gnome experience, watch the TV show and kind of see how her character arc goes there, and then watch the alternate arc in the movies, and then understand that like both of those arcs can be true, like they don't have to contradict each other, and be like, wow, this is a rich character here.
When you said get the full Cheryl Gnome experience, I thought you were going to say go to pixiv.net and just start typing stuff in without
shizzle knob.
No, go to Revo and win a statue.
Ah, this is true. That was actually Fujiko Mine that won, though, not Cheryl.
Fuck.
Close, though. Very close.
I wasn't there. Whatever.
I wasn't there, says the person who was sat next to me when I won it. When I literally said to you, oh, they announced there was a Fujiko Mine statue coming out. I was like, right, that's mine. They read out my number. I was like, wait, it is mine.
I mean, yeah, I told you also, like, I was playing Dengeki, and the statue was, like, right next to me, like, holy shit, Shadon's gonna get mad. It's like, there's no way he's gonna win this. Holy shit.
Well, at least I won something that weekend.
They announced the number, and Shadon just rises up, like, fully erect, going, yes! Yes!
You know what the best thing is, everyone who's listening at home? We're just about to move on to a quick break in which we'll be doing fanfiction, but I don't think the fanfiction Vorgeli is going to read out now is better than the one she just came up with about me at Revo.
You were screaming, though. It was so happy, honestly.
I was blown away by the fact that I literally just said, this is mine, I want this, fully expecting it to just be, and then it actually was. I was like, holy shit, I wish it was that simple to win the fucking lottery, but well, never mind. Anyway, so yes, indeed, we will now take a quick break. We'll do some fan fiction. Been in the interim, you know, just as a little palate cleanser. And we'll be back with full balls-to-the-wall, spoilerific discussion on favourite scenes, favourite characters, themes about legacies, expectations, communication, the world-building, things we unfortunately didn't like or felt were not fully developed, because I'm afraid to say Macross Del does have a share of those kind of problems. But yes, we're going to give you the full buffet when we get back right after this break. Vorgeli, please take us away when you're ready with the fanfic of the hour.
Yes, quite right, quite right. Allow me to sample an hors d'oeuvre, please, and continue. Yes.
Get me those scallops, please. Yes, today we're going to be reading a fanfiction by esteemed author Blaze Master 9.
Well, will he ever graduate to being Blaze Master 420? That's the question.
Yes. Is this the blue period of Blaze Master 9?
Well, by this point, he's been probably Blaze Master 12. He's gone up a few years, but...
Oh, well, this is his early work before he got derivative. Ah!
Just to ask guy's name, is he the ninth iteration of the Blaze Master clone project? Like, they finally got around to making, you know, the ultimate fanfic writer?
No, we need to make, like, about 38 more of them. And then one of them will pop out with barcodes in the back of his head.
I see what you did there.
He inherited the secret technique from in which you have to kill your master. Oh.
Ninth generation Blaze Master. So when they first become apprentices, they're just Blaze. And then they kill their Blaze Master and they become the next Blaze Master. But yes, so coming from ninth generation Blaze Master, we have a fanfiction called... Sorry.
We're not going to survive this, are we? We're done. We're going to die. This is going to be like going through the Stargate in 2001.
We have a fanfiction called Yoda and Tequila. Description. Like the subtitle. See what happens when Yoda drinks tequila. He does stuff Jedi do not do. Published as a New Year's present, as is required from generations of Blaze Masters, January 1st, 2006. This man, like, stayed awake from Christmas till January to bring us this masterpiece.
Do you reckon it's possibly semi-autobiographical, and that's the way he got through writing it? Is because he drank that much tequila? Like, he drank so much tequila, he wrote a fanfic involving tequila.
Oh my god. Well, he has some other fanfictions that I can just read the title. Pikachu Goes Crazy. Battle for Your Soul. Pokemon Get High.
Ha! Yep. I'm sensing a trend here.
Drunk or drunk not, there is no buzz.
Yoda and tequila. It is a quiet night, and we find Anakin Skywalker walking the streets, when all of a sudden, a man had just robed some women. Anakin runs after the man.
Robed?
Unfortunately, Anakin loses the pursuit for the assaulter takes the high ground.
But yes, a man just robed some women. Anakin runs after the man. This is all one sentence. Anakin, stop! Get back! Sorry, Anakin is a stoner now. As Anakin call out, the man keeps running. Going through a crowd, he sneaks into a night. Anakin follows him in. Anakin sees the guy and use his force pool.
Force pool.
Anakin went into a night, and Anakin followed him in. And... Anakin saw him and used his force pull. I have to repeat the exact same sentences, because it, like, really...
So he followed himself in?
No.
Is that what...
The clones of Darth Vader theory is true!
The dude snuck into a night, and Anakin followed him
okay.
in.
Okay. I see. Okay, they're going into a night.
Anakin saw him and used his force pull.
Right, God. Okay, I'm with God. You now.
What the fuck are you doing, motherfucker? Anakin, shut up! Anakin then punches the guy in the face, knocking him. The police came and took the guy to jail. As Is this an episode of Axe Cop? What the...
Not even the stormtroopers, just police.
Yeah. As Anakin is about to leave, he noted some people chatting, "Go, go, go, Anakin." Oh, sorry. As Anakin is about to leave, he noted some people chatting, "Go, go, go." Anakin went to see what was going on. Sorry, that was a single sentence. I thought it was part of the
sentence. Were they singing the Power Rangers theme tune?
Anakin was shocked of what he saw. It was Master Yoda dacing with stripers and drink a bottle of tequila.
Oh, them stripers, man. They'll corrupt your children.
Yoda. Oh, yes! Shuck that ass! I'm very proud of this.
No, you're great. Keep going.
Girls.
Please.
Hey. Anakin. Anakin. Master Yoda, what are you doing? Yoda.
Oh, fuck!
Yoda was shocked to see Anakin. No Jedi knew that Yoda would do this. Yoda.
Oh, Skywalker, what are you doing here?
Anakin. What am I doing here, you ask? What are you doing? And this is and this against the code of the Jedi. Yoda.
Look, Anakin, come with me and I will explain.
As Yoda gets off the stage, Anakin starts to follow him to a back room. The back room looks like it is reserved for Yoda. In the room, you find hoes everywhere.
Forever.
All our Twi'lek, of course.
Does he say to one of the ladies, "Forever will I dominate your destiny"? Wink, wink.
I'll leave them to me. I will deal with them myself.
How fear you? Don't tell. Let Yoda investigate.
Anakin. So, Master, start explaining. Yoda.
Well, you see, Skywalker, I come here to unwind, to have some fucking fun. It all happened 2 years ago by a kaidit. I drank a whole bottle of tequila. I was drunk as fuck. I was cussing fuck. Hoes doing crazy shit that Jedi do not do. But I realized I barely remember any of it. And I don't remember death hurt me or others. Anakin. So you're saying I can have beer and do crazy shit? I can have a bear.
Oh.
Like bear. And do crazy shit. Not beer. Bear.
Crying so much.
Yoda, no. Beer is not good. It does not get you drunk. Drink tequila. Then it's okay.
Anakin. You see, if I drink a lot of tequila, I can do crazy shit and have sex with girls. Yoda.
Yes, but the girls must be hoes like these bitches up here, cause...
No.
With hoes, you don't feel love for them.
Oh, Anakin.
Does he really?
Anakin. Okay then, give me that tequila. See in the next chapter when Anakin drinks tequila. This is the last story this person has read.
Oh, that was that because he was replaced with number 9?
Because he was killed by Blazemaster 10.
Oh, okay, let's look at Blazemaster 10. Oh my god, it exists. Oh no, it doesn't exist. Sorry.
Man. God, my brain is reeling.
There is no Blaise Master Ken. I think he died without forwarding the legacy.
No!
He never made it out of the tube.
The unbroken line of Blaise Master
exactly.
has come to
now
an end.
Now we'll never know what happens when Anakin drinks tequila. My throat hurts. Like, Stoner Anakin and Yoda, like, really make my throat hurt.
When Anakin drinks tequila, I mean, surely Watto has to show up, right? I'm a Nubian! Pass me the bottle! Your mind tricks don't work on me! But Boo sure does!
This Jew impression is surprisingly good.
That's how Watto sounds, right?
Because Watto is a racist caricature.
Is he also? Yes, all the I forget all the characters in episode one are racist.
Because George Lucas is a visionary. Okay, he made the first all black movie, so he's not racist. Even though there had been all black movies for centuries.
I mean, I would do an imitation of the Trade Federation, but then I would just
shoot her or something.
It's so bad. They're such horrible caricatures.
Oh, fuck.
Oh, my throat is also hurting.
Aren't you glad, by the way, the Windermerians are at least a million times better than the Trade Federation?
Sweet God.
I mean, the Trade Federation barely even, like, happened. Like, they were just there, and you just saw the droids. It's a bunch of robots. The Trade Federation did nothing. It's about taxes.
Space taxes.
Yeah, they should just drink some fucking tequila and make better movies.
To be fair, you do kind of have to drink tequila to get through episode one.
Oh my god, it's so true. I've tried to rewatch it at least twice and did not make it.
The true question is, so that now that Star Wars is considered anime because I read the fanfiction, do we watch Star Wars The Third Gathers Backstroke of the West, the dubbed version?
What?
What the heck is...
Why are you so upset? Is it because your father threw you off that cliff?
悪いでしょ.
Hello, ladies, gentlemen, and MBs. We've just recovered from having our sides split from learning about the generations of, what was it, Blaze Masters, and the storied history of their, you know, fan fiction, you know, legacy in the world. It was quite the experience. But we're not here to talk about, you know, the darkest, smelliest underbelly of the internet anymore. We're here now instead to talk about the good stuff, and merely some of the not-so-good stuff. That is in, of course, Macross Delta. So, first off, we're going to discuss our favourite scenes. And let's talk about snowblowers for a second.
Okay.
Yeah,
that fucking scene is where I'm like, fuck, are they actually going there? Fuck these guys.
Dude. Episode 16 ruled.
Episode 8. Most of them episodes ruled. The ones that didn't were just... They were good. They were okay. But anyway, snowblowers. So... Context, because you probably don't know what the fuck I'm talking about if you've not actually seen Delta. Ragna, the planet in which, you know, Valkyrie and Chaos, which is the company that owns, well, hosts, looks after, well, you get the idea. The planet they're based on.
PMC.
The PMC, yeah. The planet they're on is tropical. It's got very Afro-Caribbean flavour and sensibility, as well as just generally that kind of climate. And Windermere, which is where Freya comes from, because she's a Windermerian, is, well, it's Hoth, but also featuring, you know, like...
Civilization.
Ye-olde English castles and villages. Yeah. Nordic, I suppose, is the word I'd use for it.
But it's the entire planet.
There's a royal
like,
family.
I guess, yeah. Like, I'm not sure I like the trope of entire planet is one biome, and that's it. This is the snow planet. This is the water planet. This is the desert planet. Like, I mean, a bunch of movies have popularized it, but it's weird.
But I've played No Man's Sky, though. That's how it works.
Ooh.
The game is textual. And
well, the name does cue you into its target audience. So let's leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. This is true. So why is this relevant? And a couple of times in the show... by the way, I'm not talking about No Man's Sky. I'm talking about the the climates of the pursuit planets. Throughout a couple of times in the show, there's various mentions of home as a concept, and of course, there is the fact that Freya is a Windermere, hasn't been there for a while, is still very fond of the place, even if she's not so fond of what the, you know, government, or rather the kingdom is doing, in, you know, committing what is, in my opinion, war crimes against this, you know, various peoples, but we'll get to that later. And so she misses it. And it's coming up to her birthday. And so Hayate, because he actually, you know, has a surprising amount of brain cells in his head, thinks to himself, okay, what can I do to get a present for her? What could I possibly do? And he buys, or at least rents, two snowblowers, which carpet the area outside the restaurant where they all congregate, because even though they are a military company, it also has that kind of weird Cheers-like element where they all hang out in the same bar all the time. But yeah, completely carpets the area outside in snow. And of course, all the kids, like, you know, who are part of the families who look at, like, you know, who comes to the bar, like, they all freak out because they've never seen snow before, because of course it's a tropical planet. Freya goes outside and goes nuts over this because she's like, oh my god, it's like it was back then. And when she realizes that Hayase got that, you know, for her as her birthday present, she turns a shade of scarlet I didn't think I'd ever seen before. It's really, really sweet. It's such a sweet little scene between the two of them. It also involves an amazing moment where Hayase is about to touch her rune. That is not a euphemism, by the way. I've not yet explained what those are, but it's the heart shape on her head. And I honestly thought, like, if you touched that, you'd hear the Windows power off noise and she'd just fall asleep. but yeah, like, it's a really intimate, sweet moment between the two.
I hate it.
No, I'll get to it. I'll get to it. But there's one.
It's gonna break Sorry. Through that the cynical there's shell no cynical over shell. Your heart.
I'll get to that in a second, but
I'll get to it later.
but the reason I really like this is because it's a gesture that clearly took some thought on Hayate's part. Like, he didn't simply just go for chocolates or flowers. He clearly put some effort into thinking what would be, you know, something she would really appreciate. Like, you know, thought about who she was and where she's from and how important her planet is to her, even if she ultimately, you know, is branded a traitor as a result of what she's doing by singing Valkyrie. And so I really like this as a, you know, a big stepping stone in their budding romance, and also, you know, to prove that Hayate might, you know, he's got a good soft side to him. He is a bit of a, like, you know, coarse bastard in the earlier episodes.
And he's a little dense at times throughout, but in a Not in a
I will agree on pretty much everything, though, you just mentioned. It shows his kind side. It's a very sweet kind of gesture. It's a very kind of nice moment. It's too bad. It's too bad it's like the first instance where it kind of starts to establish his romance with Freya, which I hated.
Well, I can make two responses to that, one of which is they want to keep the love triangle competitive for as long as possible.
Yeah.
But
the other side had to be a quote-unquote viable option
But,
for as long as possible.
But to
the show's credit, like, she's the best. She's the bestest. But no, so what I'm saying is that this show, Delta, like, a lot of times in previous Macrosses, McRoy, the triangle will persist until basically the end, and sometimes even after that, there won't be a conclusive or definitive choice. Like, the love triangle can be a thing that there's not closure in. See the Macross Frontier television series.
I would have preferred no resolution over the resolution we got.
I'm curious what you mean, but we'll talk about it.
The reason I'm bringing this up is because this scene is so good, it's also the point in which the love triangle gets nuked out of viability for the rest of the show. As far as I was concerned, it was done.
Which I'm fine, I'm kind of fine I'm with also that, fine. Honestly.
Yeah,
like,
I'm
because
also
it doesn't,
yes.
It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be this thing where, like, it just sort of artificially hangs around until the end for the sake of drama.
Yeah, I don't think
the
show didn't really kind of revolve around the love triangle. It's kind of like more like a spectrum, and it moved from the beginning from one end of the spectrum to the other end of the spectrum at the end. So it was
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, I think, actually.
So yeah, I don't think it, like, the love triangle was a huge, like, element, but I hate what they went with. It made no sense. It was
approached in a weird way. Horrible because it affected you emotionally?
It affected me emotionally because it was horrible.
Okay. I get you.
Right. The reason I'm bringing this up now is because I've devoted a section later specifically discussing Wolf Triangle. I've got some thoughts on how you might want to execute them as a general concept. But just put a pin in this, because while this scene is amazing, it also ends the competitive element, which, as Doc has alluded to, is fine, provided that the character who loses, quote-unquote, gains something else out of it that's, you know, good for their character, or good for the drama, even, I don't know. Yeah, exactly. We're gonna get to that later when we discuss Mirage specifically, because the bugbears I have with that are significant. But let's not take that away from the fact the scene was really well animated, it was really charming, it was really touching.
Awesome scene.
It was a better romance scene, I would argue, than anything that happened in Frontier. Easily. I can't think of a better one. Doc's there. I can hear Doc's like gears grinding in his head there. He's like, wait a minute.
Yeah, I'm not really good at this sort of thing, remembering these specific moments. But like, I will say the thing that I liked about it is also, like, it wasn't like Hayate had this in mind from the beginning. Like, I will sweep her off her feet. Like, I am romance.
He just
man.
Did it.
Like, he was just sort of like at the mall with Mirage and like, what do I need to get? Like, what do I, like, you know, I don't even think, he didn't even realize how he felt about her until, I would argue, I mean, it was nascent within him, of course, but I think that conversation with Mirage in the mall kind of kickstarted his conscious thinking about like, wow, hey, I'm actually kind of in love with this girl. I need to try to do something special. I don't know, it was just, it was so true to Hayate. Really good.
You want to kill someone.
Why? Wait a minute. Why do you keep saying this? Is it because you like Mirage?
Mirage is my favorite character from the show. I'm skipping a bit, but I think as like a, she basically got tossed aside.
She ruled.
Despite her experiences and like shared experiences, her like connection, the kind of chemistry that she had with Hayate, like it all made sense. I think they would have been like a fantastic option for the ending. But no, they kind of threw it away to kind of establish the love triangle. The dude went with a girl he kind of barely knows at this point, but she can sing and make his pee-pee glow. Sorry, like, I'm getting mad. I'm getting mad over this. I'm not so much mad, rather than it's the kind of mad that makes you sit in a corner and cry silently. I'm like very heartbroken over this.
All right, can I address? I have many things to say, none of which are in disagreement, because my chiefest gripe with the show is the Mirage character arc, and we'll get to why in specific detail.
She has a wonderful character arc, but she gets tossed aside.
There's the Well, there's pieces there to build her arc and focus on it, but like there's just so many characters in this one, and like they want to give Mikumo a lot more focus in the last act, and I would argue that should have been, you know, that focus should have been given to Mirage, but like she's not part
Even
of the
so,
magical
they gave
singing
attention
stuff.
To Mikumo and. Without actually like getting anything done, like they basically got the plot forward and had a couple of scenes where Mikumo kind of goes like, "Hey, this is kind of has some weird quips." Haha, lol. I'm 3 years old. Haha, lol.
We're siblings in a weird kind of way.
Look, we're so siblings. Happy. Like the scene where they make her eat food was one of my favorite scenes because I was so happy she finally.
That got me to
tear up, because that, holy shit, like, she's finally kind of being treated as part of the group. She finally has friends. She's starting to have things that she thought she was missing out on for her purpose of singing. It was so wonderful.
Yeah.
But that's literally it.
It made me give a shit about her, whereas before I didn't very much.
Yeah. I'm in agreement about that scene. I thought it was nice, but I felt it also came way too late in the show.
Oh, I just want to finish ticking off a couple things on my list about this. I think there is hope because there's a Macross Delta, like a second movie coming out next year. And I'm hoping that in this retelling, which I think it's a retelling, and that will be my bet. It could be a sequel, it could be after, but my bet would be that these movies are an alternate retelling like Frontier. And that, like, I'm hoping in the movies he'll choose Mirage. Because I bet this TV show, like, I'm a dummy, but I, like, couldn't help but thinking the whole time, this is just they're throwing a bone to Ronka Lee fans, because Freya is kind of, in some ways, Ronka Lee reimagined, and Ronka did not get her man in Frontier, and so they won't piss off the lovers of the tiny kawaii girl again. We gotta let Freya win this one.
At the same time, like, Freya is, like, very kind of upbeat, very, like, kind of a lot less relatable than Ranka, or at least from what I remember. So it's like, yeah, I guess. But if that was their reasoning, they're kind of, I don't know, I feel like they kind of misread the situation where...
This is entirely my speculation.
I have a couple else that thoughts on, but I'll save that for later when we get to the character specifically. So for favorite scenes, Doc, have you got a favorite scene you want to bring up?
Okay, let me find them. So these scenes are kind of similar, so I'll bring them up together. The one in episode 2 where Valkyrie does the V for Vendetta shit and puts Freya into this, like, situation that she believes is real, and it's like her life is under threat and she has to, like, sing. And then there's a scene in episode 8 in which Freya sings to an enemy soldier to cure him.
Oh man.
And, like, those are kind of similar to me, and they both early on, these scenes, like, really cemented my caring about this show. And, like, those scenes just gave me chills.
Yeah,
like, the music was so good, and they were just very incredible, like, emotionally resonant scenes. And, like, music, Freya's voice, the music kind of curing VAR syndrome and you seeing it happen is, like, a very literal, almost kind of mechanical distillation of, like, some of the themes of the Macross franchise.
I'd argue it's the entire franchise summed up in a single scene, because...
The entire franchise summed up in a single scene is the scene with the dude that summed up the entire franchise. There was one of those.
Yeah, it can be a little meta, this show.
Yeah, this is true. But just to give some context here, in episode 8, the team, both the actual pilots and Valkyrie themselves, infiltrating a planet of cat people called, the planet's called Voldor. By the way, this features also one of your favourite scenes, Doc, which we'll come back to in a bit, which involves puns. The best puns ever.
That whole fucking episode, dude.
It was magnificent.
It might be the best episode of the show. It's so good.
So here's the thing, right? The way VAR syndrome works is it doesn't necessarily control everyone. I think that it can be selective. Because, spoilers, the Windermerians are actually using VAR syndrome deliberately to mind control people en masse. That's how they're doing it. That's the crossover I mentioned before. And they're using it to expand their influence in the globular cluster, as it's called, which is the section of the galaxy Windermere is in, as a big, you know, middle finger back to the nuns. Again, how stupid is
that? Aren't there people who are immune?
Something fold receptors, something. So Hayate was immune. All of the members of the Valkyrie group were also immune.
Well, yes, but the thing is, on Voldor, at least from what we see in the episode, only the military are under VAR control. The civilian populace aren't, which makes sense. Why bother having them under control? It's effort. Don't do that. Keep the military, you know, in line, get martial law in place. Why is this relevant? Because we get a scene in which Freya and Hayate, and I think possibly Mirage as well, I can't remember the specifics, encounter two kids yelling at a mech that's standing guard outside a base. Who's in the mech? It's their father. But their father is under VAR syndrome control. So he's just there, completely ignores them, and they're screaming out like, Dad, no, 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 like, what are you doing? Come back. Like, because they probably haven't seen
it. At some point, they were singing the Valkyrie songs also.
Oh, yeah, that broke my heart, the little girl. Oh.
that almost felt like fairy tale stuff at that point, and not in a bad way, by the way. I'm just saying that, like, it felt like, you know, like, reaching out to a mystical power, and like, well, I can't do it, but then they literally get their prayers answered later, as what happens with the scene in which they encounter the dad again. Because the dad in question, when the final battle kicks off after Valkyria discovered, fights Hayate. Hayate won't kill him, even though he's pinned down and is about to be killed by this guy. Again, because he's under mind control, he doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. So Hayate does have the option to kill him, but Freya intervenes and actually sings at him, and that releases him from the VAR control. So that, to me, literally is the Macross experience, which is, you know, Hayate could kill him, they could fight, you know, and rip each other to shreds, but the greater force, the better force here is a force of, you know, peace and caring and love. So yeah, that scene, especially with the song that Freya sings, which is probably my favourite Valkyrie song of all, I don't remember the title of it, but it's so bittersweet and melancholy. I fucking love it. I got chills. I was like, yeah, I was on the verge of breaking down, because it's just how powerful it was.
Literally, like every single time they were singing, like after episode 5 or so, I had tears in my eyes, because again, emotionally resonant is like,
I know,
very like good way to put it. They're a lot of them are like very melancholic songs, and the kind of scenarios aren't necessarily realistic, but it's not hard to kind of imagine the emotional stress and like the emotions people are going through and kind of put yourself in the situation. So I think it resonates with the themes of the show quite well.
Yeah, indeed. This is the thing about Valkyrie as a concept, because you could argue, not without some merit I would say, that the reason Valkyrie exists as far as narrative goes is because they can sell us a product. You know, look at this thing we can keep making money from after the facts. I think Gwyn Campbell, when he spoke to UDoc in the Frontier cast, said that indeed they, you know, there was quite a lot of merchandising for Frontier.
Oh, he'd know. He sold so much soup.
So
yeah.
Oh, he's gonna say things to that, I'm sure.
Yeah, there were like Frontier desserts.
Yeah, they were selling lipstick brands like based Cheryl, I think, mm-hmm. that he specifically mentioned. Hell, they're still releasing merch now. They're releasing a set of Cheryl's earrings.
Why Cheryl? Yes, I know who Cheryl is, but you know. Why Cheryl? Why not release some silent hacker products?
Oh, goodness. Oh, I bet they have. I just don't know about it. But, you know, they told, like, Valkyrie is a big deal in Japan for sure. Like, the thing that, just to speak on the Frontier stuff, because it affects Delta, like, I feel like the, and I believe Gwen said this outright, like, the success of Frontier in the female audience was really, really marked and very, I don't know if it was surprising, but I think you can see in Delta that, like, they know that they're not just writing a show for boys, and that it's really cool.
Yeah. And the reason I bring this up is because I think it's fair to say that the music in Macross, which we'll get to, in Delta specifically, which we'll get to later, because I've designated a specific section for it, but just to put it up front here for people who might be skeptic, it's not for its own sake, and it's not just for the, you know, the merchandising element. Oftentimes when they're singing in the show, apart from it just being to do the, you know, whole Cure the Bar shit, it actually has poignance to it. There's a scene I'll get to with Kaname in a bit that involves a song of hers specifically.
Kaname!
Wow. Like, again, you could very well argue that they're making this music to sell. But, and they are, to a certain extent. Like, you know, they can do both. But they also use the music appropriately to do some really strong character moments, such as the one in which Freya sings to that dad. So yeah, kudos to the show for doing that, for having its cake and eating it by, you know, merchandising the fuck out of it in a way that would make Gene Simmons envious, but at the same time actually having some resonance to it and some meaning. Fuck.
Hear, hear.
Right. Well, I have a bunch, but since I mentioned Silent Hacker. Silent Hacker!
Yeah! That's like, listen. Nope, you know what? I'll let you talk. Why am I fucking hacking your
You're not very silent about it. That's the
stealing
fucking
your
show.
Thunder. I'm sorry. Please, you have the floor.
So That was, I think, basically the first time where they showed more attention to, like, Machina and Reyna, the two sort of more, not so much mm-hmm. more quiet, but less prominent members of the group. Reyna
unsung
is
heroes,
like,
I would
the
say.
Most quiet person. She's kind of like the sort of cute, quiet hacker sort of type. But this was like kind of the first time where they
aloof.
showed attention to these characters. It was really wonderful. Like they sung very well. It was a very kind of like different song with a different kind of like mood to it than the rest of the show, and it was really kind of fun to at least have. And also very prominently showcasing that these two characters are super gay. So I'm all for it. Super gay.
Super.
Awesome.
Super duper. Her name, it is awesome. Reyna, like, Reyna Prowler is such a fantastic name.
I know.
That's like a top anime name ever.
Oh, either that or it's the name of like a film noir character, like Reyna Prowler totally. Is out on the streets and fighting crime.
And like when they do the song, like the I thought they were going to come back to it. I was disappointed we only heard it in episode 7, but
yeah, we only really heard their kind of solo performance in episode 7. They don't really do it too much in terms of singing in the rest of the episodes, and it was kind of sad.
Mm-mm.
But oh well.
There's like some stuff near the end where they get to take the mic for a little bit, but yeah, like I was texting Shadon. Like, if you just YouTube, you know, Macross Delta Silent Hacker, and you see, you just see the the camera work is amazing.
I know.
Like, as they're saying, Silent Hacker, and they're like, for each syllable, like, panning across each girl, and then whoosh to the next girl, and then it made me so happy. I watched it over and over and over and over.
The tandem hacking also was so adorable. Like, you get hit by the firewall, and then your gay friend is there, or your girlfriend is there to kind of catch you, bring you back to the hacking, and also hack with you. It's fucking amazing.
Well, this is the thing, like, that is another, like, reminder of one of the themes of Macross in general, which is that people, you know, can be as skilled as they want at the various things they do, such as, you know, like, well, as we'll discuss with Messa, or, you know, Keith and all that, you know, they're all super talented, but that's not a thing compared to the power of, you know, supporting each other, as happens, you know, multiple times with Freya and Hayate, and even Hayate and Mirage. So that's just another little reminder of that.
Dude, Reyna and Machina, you see four to blow a cat-shaped hole in the wall.
They do.
Yeah, I know.
It was shaped like a cat. God damn it. It's the best.
So good. And one final thing I'll add about the Silent Hacker is that, let's be honest here, computer hacking can be super fucking boring.
I mean, realistic computer hacking.
It really can. Just
furiously typing.
Yeah, just,
I'm typing.
Just, can you just imagine Reyna there, like, typing on this, like, holographic keyboard?
I mean, you know, literally, yeah, like, literally any other anime, she's like, I hacked in. I hacked. I did it. I have to bypass the firewall. And then it's like, the other people are kind of looking, and they're like, holy shit, are you in? So it's like, no, this was the best hacking scene ever.
The only thing that I would argue comes close to this hacking scene is the similarly looking, but not as quite as good scenes in which Ed was doing hacking from
what
Cowboy
about,
Bebop.
It actually really reminded me of the movie Hackers, because they had a similar sort of visualization of cyberspace and, like, hacking, with, like, kind of viruses and, like, attacks kind of being, like, portrayed as, like, I don't know, an animal or, like, a specific thing, like the Cookie Monster virus. It fills your screen with the Cookie Monster, and you have to type cookie.
Was that before the invention of cookies as, like, an internet thing? That's amazing. That's prescient.
You haven't watched Hackers?
It's on my very long to-do list.
The movie is, like, horrible, but it's amazing. Like, it's horrible, and that's why it's amazing.
It's a very strong slice of the 90s. And in fact, funnily enough, that's what I think of when I think a little bit of Delta's hacking. It's, like, it's very 90s, but it's like, you know, It's colourful, it's interesting to watch, it enhances the relationship between the two characters. Like, we learn about them. Like, we learn things, you know, from just observing them and their behaviour towards each other. It's super sweet as well.
It's like
it.
The Dark Souls of anime. You know, classic mechanics, but recontextualized in a more
all
a
those things are true about Dark Souls.
With a modern outlook.
I'll be back after I respawn.
I'm a journalist now. Can I get paid?
I am super impressed with your level of restraint that you didn't make that reference earlier.
Reyna, you picked up a shield. What does the lore say?
Oh, fuck. Right, so, favorite scenes. The other one that I'm going to mention is... Well, the thing is, this is not so much a favorite scene, it's just everything that happens during the arc, and I can't really talk about it because I want to save it for the full bloated discussion we'll give to it. I'm just going to say this, right? Big spoilers, Messer fucking dies at some point.
Oh,
like,
fuck.
He gets blown the fuck up. Like, yeah.
Rip Messer.
Yeah. Who is Messer, by the way? He's like the top gun. He's the maverick of Delta Flight. He's the best pilot there is. So, why am I bringing up this? Because, well, the thing is, right, if you wanted to, like, do a show in which a main or rather a close to a cast member dies, I would say that, you know, a lot of shows would not have the dignity or the time to then properly address the after effects of that, or even just to do something as simple as a funeral, or, like, you know, a wake, even. And what I adored about what happened with Messer's death, not the fact that he actually died, mind you, is the fact that we not only get a really good funeral scene and a wake scene and a, you know, specific cultural thing that they do, you know, for Ragnar's, where they, like, send off a model of Messer's ship into the sea. Set, by the way, to that same song again that I adore, which just left me, like,
mm-hmm.
I was just saying, like, hand on chest, like, off you go, soldier, into that long good night. We also get a scene for the Aerial Knights, which are the Windermerian ace pilots. And they discuss Messer's death, and of course you've got Bo going around, like, being like, ha 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 ha, get fucked, Valkyrie! Because that's how he goes. But what I really appreciate about this little moment is that Keith, the man who actually killed him, tells him to shut the fuck up and show some respect. Like, this is the thing about the Aerial Knights in general, it's exemplified in this scene. They're not cartoon villains. They have motivations, no. They have complexity, and they even have sympathy and understanding for people they fight against. Like, Keith respected Messer as a pilot and as a soldier. And so even after killing him, in a moment where you think Keith would be, like, all, you know, smug, like, well, the Grim Reaper got reaped, shall we say. He reaps what he sowed.
Or, like, the Grim Reaper got fucked.
Shinigami, more like Shinigon, man. God of death.
Yeah.
More like God of
Shinigami,
man.
More like Shin.
Am I right? More like shit.
Oh,
as
it's a pilot shit.
Boom! Up here, Bogue. Way up here.
But yeah, like, Keith shows some genuine respect and admiration and tells his fellows to get in line and, you know, have some respect for the man who was that good a pilot. And it gives him and the Aerial Knights a bit more dimension, and that's the thing that they keep getting, which really took me back. I was super impressed by the fact that, like, even Bogue, even, you know, Clown Prince of, you know, assholery that he is, even he gets a bit of dimension to him with his motivations. Every single Aerial Knight, with perhaps the exception of the two twins who I
just didn't show
names,
up.
They just didn't. Yeah. They weren't really there. But the ones that we get a lot of screen time for, they all get, you know, not complex even, but relatable motivations. They're three-dimensional villains. And that also ties into the wider point, which is that...
Are they even villains?
Hey, there you go. Dude, I liked them way more than I thought I would. Like, when... Initially, I was kind of underwhelmed by the setup and the character design of them. It's like, oh, great, a bunch of pretty boys to take away the focus from Valkyrie.
I know, right? Holy shit. Why do the villains have to be, like, the effeminate dudes that all look awesome? But no, very slowly it gets to establish that they might not really be the villains. It's like a civil war where both sides have rights and wrongs.
Yep. Mm-hmm. There's only one minor... sort of design doc quibble. Some of the names of the villains
Keith.
Are not very imposing.
Keith?
Keith the Mighty. And how am I supposed to take anything seriously Roy. From a man
His
called
His name
Roy?
Was Royd. Holy shit. Lord Royd.
Yeah. Lord Royd! Hail!
I will
he is
say...
an ass, so there is that, I suppose.
Oh my God. I will say it looks more badass when you hear it in Japanese, so maybe...
Doido-sama.
Why, speaking of Doido-sama, why did he decide to set up shop in an abandoned lens crafters?
He really did go to Specsavers.
Just a fucking optometry center right there in his office. Just a wall of glasses. Why?
No. Look, there's just literally no laser eye surgery in the future of Macross. Transforming planes of giant frigates? Yeah, we got all up in that shit. But fucking laser surgery to correct your vision? Nah, impossible.
Look, there is laser surgery to correct your vision now, and I'm not doing it because I think I look better with glasses. So shut it. He also looks better with glasses.
Yeah, I'm not doing it either, also.
Well, the reason he has glasses is so he can do the classic anime trope of when he's being sinister. His eyes go cloudy.
Yeah, right. No, the middle finger, like, fix the glasses thing.
Ah, yes, that too.
Indeed. Like, I can't wait to talk about Windermere later and get into the weeds on that.
Yeah.
That's going to be good.
That will be good. Right, I've had that scene. Anyone else want to chip in with a favorite scene?
Yeah, in episode 13, Mirage catches Hayate in Gerwalk mode, and I was just, like, screaming thank you at my fucking computer. I was like, yes, fucking finally one of the heroines, the ladies, catch the boy, because in every single Macross in episode 1 or 2, the boy, the man, the male hero, catches the love interest by the hand in Gerwalk mode. And the fact that they inverted this trope in this episode ruled. Unfortunately, as we've discussed, like, the whole Mirage thing didn't pan out. But boy, at that moment, I was thrilled. That was a great scene for me as a longtime Macross fan.
Vog, do you have another favorite scene you want to chip in with?
I'm not going to say the scene where, the Hayate hugs Mirage, because that's a short scene. But they go through some stuff. Fuck, I have two more scenes. I guess I'll go with the better one. It's pretty early on in one of the first battles with the Windermere people. Two of them basically single Mirage out. And they're like, okay, I'm going to weaken Mirage. You're going to, like, kill her. And they end up kind of cornering her. She is just kind of... her only option is to basically block the bullets, but she's running out of energy. There's nothing she can do. Hayate notices, like, just rushes towards her. And, like, he... Up to that point, he's been trying to kind of get closer to enemy aircraft to target non-vital parts, to not kill anyone. So he's, like, speeding towards the battle. Where, like, these two people are just firing at Mirage. And he's like, realizes at some point that he can't get close enough to get, like, a non-lethal hit on the thing. So he makes his, like, first conscious decision to kill someone. Because that would save Mirage. Like, that's a huge, like...
Mm-hmm.
That scene, what follows, ends up being, like, a pretty kind of huge... having a huge emotional impact on... Hayate, and kind of strengthening his tie with Mirage. And I thought it was nice.
No, you're absolutely right.
It was great. I think that's episode 6.
Man, you remember that shit? Holy shit.
No, I took a episode by episode notes. It's the only reason I remember.
This is the one time where I didn't take notes.
I understand. It was hard to, like, pull myself away from the screen to write. I just wanted to, like, keep... play, but I had to. Yeah, it took me longer to watch this show than I normally would. But I wanted to remember stuff. Oh, speaking of, I forgot actually. Like when I was talking about the scene in which Mirage caught Hayate, and I talked about it as like, oh, this is satisfying for me, a Macross fan, because it was trope inversion. But also, I think for Mirage, it was an incredible scene because it was one of the first, if not the first times, where she like freeform flew. Like she's always been accused by Messer, by the Windermerians, of like being like sort of too rigid and flying only by the book and predictably, like what are the best things to do according to the percentages of survival or whatever. But like then she just throws all that out the window and doesn't think too hard and starts to fly more like Hayate instinctually, like for just a reason that, oh, I have to save this guy. And man, like it was good shit.
Right.
It was good shit that they felt like they walked back actually a little bit.
After that, kind of. I mean, like, yeah. They established kind of early on that, oh my god, Freya's song makes Hayate feel like he's flying, like the airplane isn't even there, he's just kind of freeform flying better than before. But it kind of like just, they kind of drop it for a bit, then it shows up again when it's convenient, and they kind of drop it again, then at some point it's convenient. And like, yeah, there is a bunch of these that kind of don't end up paying off as much until later. I feel like some of these like kind of subplots were dragged quite a bit, but
Does anyone else have any favorites? Go on, Doc. What else do you want to chuck in?
I'm going to bring up Mikimo, despite being annoyed with her early on. By the end, it's, you know, I quite liked her. And in episode 18, when she like she sings her song with such force. And she's got a really much deeper voice than the other singers. I think just this fuller, richer sound. Not that the others are bad, but I just it felt like a lower tone. Like it brings the king, it brings Hines to his knees, and I was just like, "Wow, that's fucking awesome!" And he was just like, "Wow, what is this song?" Like I've been knocked flat by it. You know, it was great.
Yeah, kind of like the scene where Freya, basically like the entire group, gets shot in the battle for Ragna, the first of about 5,000 in this show. And then, like, Freya is basically the one of the only people kind of still, like, functional. And she ends up, like, just jumping off of a platform to reach Hayate better. So, off of, like, tons of kilometers up in the air, just falls off, uses some like jetpacks to kind of glide closer. She starts like singing as she's falling down. I thought that was really cool.
I hear you on that.
So good.
Do I have any more scenes? Oh, come on, we completely forgot the great introduction to episode 8 where we the cat puns. Like,
oh, episode 7.
Episode
so
7,
good.
Sorry, you're right.
Yes.
Yeah, like, so, because it is, the planet Voldor is like a race, like a home world of a race of cat people, they of course all wear cat ears, like disguise themselves as the natives rather than sticking out like a sore thumb as they otherwise would. That being said, they're all color coordinated characters, so you'd think they'd spot them out in the crowd, whatever, who cares. So, Freya, in the best way possible, for reasons I'll explain in a second, decides to start playing this by saying cat puns all the time. Like, Mirage is cocking a fucking pistol. And she says, no more cat puns. And Freya goes, apologies.
They make more sense in Japanese, but yeah.
Yeah. You know what the funny thing is about this, right? Like, the cat puns are grown some in reality, but they are funny. I'm not going to lie.
They're great. Good job by the fan subbers.
Oh, hell yeah. Especially given they're coming from Freya, who it is in her character to be cheeky. Like, she has a very mischievous, like, impish laugh that I found really endearing. So it makes sense, but one of the things I really liked about this is that it first was in character, it secondly wasn't tonally dissonant, and thirdly, it reminded people of the fact that, you know, like, oh yeah, there is a war on, but we can still be human beings, we can still have just these brief, tiny little moments of not taking things too seriously. I mean, you wouldn't hear SEAL Team 6 doing that shit, of course, but I really appreciate the fact that it's just a reminder that they can still have a little bit fun, be regular, their regular selves every now and again. I do also say that when Doc posted this particular scene on Twitter, because it was the scene just of Mirage cocking the gun, I just thought she was just going to end it all. She was just like, I can't cope with this shit anymore.
Takes aim at Freya,
I've only got one bullet.
Can we talk about when Kaname took charge and did the singing?
Please. Please. I would love to talk about
another one of my
favorite
scenes.
The lady with the bestest hats, by the way.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. But yeah, she's like the previous sort of leader of the group before Mikumo showed up. And she ended up kind of getting put a bit to the side because of Mikumo's arrival and Mikumo like being so much better than everyone else. But early, like, she ends up at some point, like, everyone else in the group is basically incapacitated, which is might see a theme with my previous favorite scene. But I mean, these are kind of good ways to spotlight a specific character, and they happen like far enough apart in the episodes where, you know, you don't kind of notice it. But yeah, it was, I thought it was really wonderful when she started singing the song that she did.
Axia. Just...
the same song in a life or death fight, I think, with what was his name? The guy that dies. I mean, wait.
Messer.
Yeah, with Messer. The same song, I think, that kind of saved him from becoming a Var, like in the past. A song that he's very, like, that is very dear to his heart. A song that he, like, hasn't heard live ever since, I think. But, yeah.
No! He has it on his little watch MP3 player!
He has it on his Fitbit!
He has, like, a literal bracelet that only has this song on it. Like, that's how much it means to him. And she ends up singing it again in, like, this life or death battle. I think it's beautiful.
It rules, man.
I appreciate that as well for Kaname not only singing that just for Messer's sake, but I'd argue also for her own.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that's another aspect.
She could have very picked another song from the library that they've got of songs while Curie. But that one was personal to her and, you know,
she wrote
Messer.
That one,
and not only was she...
basically.
Yeah, exactly. So not only was she singing it for his benefit, she was singing it to remind herself that she can still do this solo. It was specifically mentioned by her that prior to joining Valkyrie, she was just a regular idol.
And then she quit to become a manager.
And she's still singing with him, right?
For a while.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Right, before she joined up with the tactical unit, she was a manager and then was, like, totally out of the business and wanted to join the army. Okay. And luckily for her and for us, she has fold receptors.
That's what they're called. You're right. Yes. Okay, cool. But yeah, even after the song ends and everyone magically comes back to life, the rest of the group, she does directly tell Mikumo that, yeah, I can still do this. You have competition.
I got this. Mm. Step off.
Yeah, absolutely.
Man.
It was such a short plot for her, but it was very welcome.
They revisited it. Like, she has, I think, like 3 or 4 episodes that are very solid, like for a secondary character. I mean, you could argue she might be a little more well developed than some of the primary ones. She's got a lot of meat on the bone there, character wise.
Yeah, the one where they're in jail, like her, they kind of sit and like goes through her whole backstory, the kind of challenges she faced. She gave her a lot of character.
I mean, you could argue she was in the real love triangle. Am I right? Messer, Captain Arad, and her.
I was going to say that too, but I think that love triangle ended with the correct option.
But it did nothing. Fucking Captain Arad just doesn't do anything. What are you doing?
No, they were already hanging out, dude. They were already, like, getting on it.
I hope so.
What the hell are you
talking
about? I hope
off-screen it was happening.
Yeah, it was pretty evident that they were spending huge amounts of time together off-screen.
He was clearly swashbuckling with Miss Buccaneer. There you go.
Kaname Buccaneer.
What a name, by the way.
It's also a top-tier name, Kaname Buccaneer.
Yes.
Do we have any more favorite scenes you want to bring up, or should we start moving on to the broader topics of discussing individual characters?
Let's move on.
Okay. So, we've covered our favorite scenes, and now we're going to start talking about the themes of the show, and there is one theme that lurches, like, Ben-Hur, like, opening credit style, bigger than all others, in my opinion, in this show, which is legacies and expectations! Yeah, I really, honestly, like, it's the thing that applies to everything and everyone in this show, without exception. Even minor characters like, God, what was the name of the Zentradi commander again? What was his name?
Why can't I? I can't remember.
So Zentradi
often narrated the sort of intros.
Yeah. So Mr. Zentradi commander, whose name I forget, even he, this theme applies to him a little. I mean, he's only a side character.
The green dude?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ernest Johnson?
Ernest Johnson.
His voice actor, like, can we just...
Alistair!
Very brief, like, thing to talk about the voice actors. I recognized so many of these voice actors, because the voice actor for this dude was the same voice actor as, like, Joseph in JoJo's.
Oh my god!
I recognized, like, old Joseph somewhere there. I recognized Yellow Temperance.
Wow.
From one of the main characters, not main characters, from one of the more prominent characters. I'm like, holy fuck, you brought Yellow Temperance here.
Man.
He's, the voice actor for Ernest passed away recently, didn't he?
Aww.
Did he? Oh my god, really? Wait.
For old Joseph Joestar? I want to say
Oh, you're
right!
Oh shit, you are correct! Man. Rest in peace, Joseph.
Yeah,
Damn, that
Unsho Ishizuka, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah, August 13th.
Yeah, he was... Yeah, that's... August... Oh my god, that's so sad.
That sucks.
I love this guy.
He was great.
Rest in peace, Ishizuka-sensei.
So, legacies and expectations. What are we talking about?
I also recognized the voice actor, I think, for... the first main villain from the Kaiji series.
Oh,
Tonegawa.
The person that actually buys the rest of the cards in the first arc
in the boat. I don't remember.
Yes, he was there. I heard the voice. He was one of the Windermerians.
I see. Okay, so legacies and expectations. What are we talking about when we mean this? Basically, every character has some sort of history behind them, be it from themselves or their relatives or friends, that in some way weighs them down a little bit, or even a lot. And some of it is history that they may not even know of in full, and that particularly applies to Hayate and Mikumo, as it happens. So we're going to go through these step by step. I'm just going to say up front, though, I do really like Macross Delta, but if I have one particular gripe with it, is that when it comes to this theme, we only get Cliff's Notes for each character on what it means to them, and not the full fat treatment I would prefer. That applies to pretty much every character I can name here. And with the exception, I would argue, of actually the Windermerians, as it happens, for a variety of reasons, but certainly the main trio, and certainly Mikumo in particular.
Very interesting for a show that itself has quite a story legacy.
Indeed, that's the meta theme of it. That is the meta theme of it, because as it'll turn out, the events of Delta are indeed because of what happened in Frontier. That's the legacy. That's like the idea behind it. And the thing is, as a whole, the proto culture, the Protheans of this particular story, if you're a Mass Effect fan, were featured. They've been mentioned numerous times in previous series. I mean, they were certainly mentioned in Frontier, but they were never the driving force, or even an influence on the events of the show proper, I would argue, at least not in Frontier. In Delta, what people think of the what people think of the protoculture, what they meant and who they left their legacy behind for, is the subject of varying interpretations. The Windermerians even have an idea of manifest destiny that's because of, you know, their belief, which is semi-true, that they are the inheritors of the protoculture's legacy. So there's even that, like, it applies not just to characters, but also to the cultures and civilizations, and particularly the Windermerians.
Yeah, I would characterize what the nuns have as very much manifest destiny. Like, they want to unify, they believe it's, like, their mission to unify all humanity and unite the galaxy together, politically, and, you know, that just feels like a James K. Polk speech.
Mm. By the way, if you're when we say Manifest Destiny, you might be thinking, wait, are you referring into the context of what happened in colonialization era America? Put that in the back of your mind. That'll be relevant later.
Yes.
Regrettably, unfortunately. So, let's talk about the main trio. What are their legacies and their expectations? So, here's the thing. Let's start with Hayate. Hayate has a father and a mother, of course. He wasn't conceived in a test tube. His dad was never really around, but it turns out...
Unlike another character in this series. Wait, what?
Spoiler. So, Hayate's dad was a pilot. But he wasn't, you know, just a trade pilot. He was the best star pilot in the galaxy. No, of course. Sorry.
Macross Jesus, Hayate Sr.
Indeed. Hayate Sr. Was actually on Windermere when the Civil War first broke out.
I think it's, what is he called? Wright Eamelman?
Wright Eamelman. Even yes. though, unfortunately, he was wrong Eamelman.
He's a right Eamelman, that one.
Yeah, he was wrong Eamelman in the end. Oops.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. What happened, by the way, this is something that will also, funnily enough, tie into the Legacies and Expectations theme, is that we learn early on in the show that on Windermere, a weapon called a Dimensional Eater, which you can read as basically the Tsar Bomber, the nuke, was dropped on a Windermerian village.
It bends space and time to destroy everything. This summer, an ethereal...
Is this a Roland Emmerich film? Fuck. But yeah, it basically drops a retro wave coloured and flavoured black hole. And the thing about this, right, nukes of course leave behind radiation. They do leave their effects are felt for a long time afterwards. I mean, while it wasn't a nuke, you can't go to Chernobyl or the area around it because it's going to be contaminated for tens of thousands of years. Here's the thing, this dimensional eater left a crater on Windermere that is still streaking lightning out of it to the day of the events that this show takes place in. It was an act of genocide, I would argue. I mean, didn't have to kill every one of them, but it certainly intended to, shake them into line. And so here's the thing. Who was piloting the jet that dropped that nuke, for all intents and purposes? It was Hayate's father.
Or was it?
Well...
Didn't the autopilot take over?
No. What he basically did is they probably told him to go into a very populated area. He didn't want to, so he tried to go over like wilderness. Then they got the autopilot, and then he's like, okay, I'm gonna detonate it like immediately. He detonated it over like a small village, I think. So yeah, he didn't end up causing that much damage. So what he did was kind of sacrifice himself after he got found out to detonate the thing somewhere where there were no people. But there were people because he couldn't get all the way out because they found him
out. This will be relevant to Bogue later as well as it happens. His hate boner is actually somewhat justified, even if it is very specific to Alcuri and not the nuns, but well. So here's the thing, right, about this whole plot point. This, in theory... on paper, and you're going to hear me say this variation of this phrase a lot, makes for an excellent character dilemma, because it's the sins of the father thing. The Windermerians immediately, when they learn of this fact, latch onto the relation, and they all want to kick the shit out of Hayate because of what his dad did. Now, the Windermerians are not privy to the truth of the matter, which I did find a bit perplexing given that the voice recording that later proves his innocence was actually in the VF-22, which they kept as a trophy of him doing that in the first place.
Not they just kept as a trophy. They very carefully reconstructed it.
Yeah.
So they somehow reconstructed the entire audio file without listening to it.
I hadn't thought of that like all the way through, but yeah, they did.
They didn't listen to it. Now... maybe you can make the argument they wouldn't have believed in. That's fine. Here's my problem with this, and people are going to fucking hate me for this, but I'm standing by this take. I think that the show copped out by not making Hayate's father directly responsible for the nuke. Yeah, I went there.
Yeah, like, the way this kind of resolve was like, oh, here's this MacGuffin. It says your dad was innocent. Oh, my dad was innocent. nothing ever happened again about this.
Yeah.
This evidence didn't get shown to anyone.
The reason I bring this up, though, is because I've been thinking about this, like, problem I have with this plot point for a while. I firstly thought, well, the fact that Rayna literally pulls it from thin air in the start of the next episode suggests to me that I would speculate this is actually a change to the scripts, and they probably did intend it to be true that Hyacinth's dad did that. Why else, you know, keep him, like, mostly hidden away? We don't even see a picture of him until, like, the final two episodes. We don't, like, have a flashback from Hyacinth's sexy remembering him. But here's the thing, right? Whatever way this plays out, be it that he did end up doing it as I feel it should have been, or the one we get, the issue I have with this is that the resolution takes away the choice that the process of Hayate processing this knowledge and dealing with it and coming to terms with it. This, they start using it for like maybe all of a single shot to drive a wedge between him and Freya, because Freya, of course, is a Windermerian. She actually witnessed it happen. She witnessed people be turned to dust. So while I think that, you know, she'd obviously, you know, get past that and say, you know, he's not his dad, it's still something I would reasonably believe her to, you know, go have doubts like, holy shit, like, how can I like this guy when his dad did this horrible thing? But they don't really do anything with it in the end, in my opinion. The process of dealing with it and Hayate's ultimate decision, whatever that is, you know, on how he chooses to deal with it, like, you know, I'm not my dad, or okay, maybe I am my dad, but I can and will do better. You know, that is ultimately not something that he does himself, and I felt kind of disappointed at that.
When that first happened, I was like, doot, 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 ring, ring. Hello, hello, Mirage. This is Doc. Hayate's available. Go in. Because I was like, Freya is going to, like, be pretty repelled by it, but she overcame it quite quickly. Like, she is another character that doesn't seem really tied down by the expectations of her culture either.
Yeah, like, she's at least reasonable enough to be like, yeah, you know, it was kind of sad that your dad did it, but you're not your dad, so, I mean.
Indeed.
So, like, just to play the devil's advocate, I'll throw out, I guess maybe the reason they wanted to make Wright innocent is because Wright is Jesus and can do no wrong and did everything in the show to bring all the characters together.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So he can't be a bad guy. No, but seriously, I think the reason might be to give the Windermerians something to be wrong about, I guess, so that they can kind of be wrong, like, about something, because they seem so very right about most of the political issues.
I wouldn't agree there either, but...
But, and I feel like they want to, it kind of adds, I think, a layer, despite, like, what you may feel of it being, like, a cop-out for Hayate's character, and I don't necessarily disagree, like, I think it adds a layer to the whole legacies bit, because, you know, legacy can be, like, it's something you inherit, like history, and history is malleable and can be hijacked and weaponized by the wrong people, and so the legacy that you buy into, you Windermerians, you Ragnans or whoever, like, at some point you didn't see all this stuff happen yourself. You might not know all the facts and you could be being manipulated. And so legacy as a sort of thing to define your life may not be the wisest of decisions. Mm. And this is sort of illustrative of that.
I'm in total agreement. I just wish
you do it.
I'm in agreement, but I just wish, as I will wish with a lot of things that we'll discuss shortly, that they just devoted more time to it.
More time? What are you talking about? So he has to live with that shit before and during a huge mission to Windermere in which he gets captured and faces charges for it. What the hell? They had tons of time to develop it, and they did, and they threw in the element that Doc mentioned, that, yeah, like, the history you kind of subscribe to was written by people who want you to believe certain things. And, like, you know, the history, like, is not necessarily the beliefs that you have might not necessarily, like, reflect the truth. You might not have the whole facts and stuff. And that, I think that narrative and, like, the way it was explored, while also providing the narrative of, like, Hayate has to deal with this shit. And Hayate does have to deal with this shit. It's Mirage the savior, best character of this show that actually brings the point that, hey, maybe that's not what happened. She stands up for Hayate. So what the hell? I thought it was developed and handled pretty well, with like more meaning than just, oh, Hayate might be sad.
Maybe this is just me, but I don't think, I didn't read it that way. To me, I think what I'm seeking when I think of like what they could have done with this, I just wanted to see some introspection or rumination. Brief, it doesn't need to be long, it doesn't need to be melancholy or melodramatic or like overly, you know, hammy. I just wanted more time to the characters talking about it and maybe how I say, look, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Let's find out. I'll just have his perspective.
You know where I would want that introspection more? Like, I didn't miss it from here. I missed the exact same thing from a different part where when they actually find out that Nuns actually dropped the bomb. Like, that's not given the introspection that needs. Like, they basically are like, well, it was bad, but, well, big organizations and big alliances have their skeletons in their closet.
Chuck! Fucking, is that what Chuck says? Like, well, I guess they would have got into some bad shit.
Yeah, that's exactly what he fucking... And that's exactly, like, where they leave it. Like, well, people do bad stuff sometimes. Whatever.
Oh, Minmay's on the phone.
You do realize, by the way, that Chuck is the one saying that when earlier in the show his own planet had a dimensional eater dropped on it by the Nuns.
Oh my god, Chuck.
You fucking nitwit, honestly.
Him and I was just gonna ask you, I don't know if introspection from Hayate would have felt right, because he's not a very
he
was an introspective type. Maybe I'm not giving him enough credit. I mean, he does have sentimental moments, like talking about his mom and shopping, but like, I don't know, he strikes me as more of a, like, an action-oriented kind of dude, and less like a brooder.
Well, I mean, that would just add more weight, like, it would add more dimensions to his character if we did see him in that situation.
That's true.
But still, like, that's I don't fair. Think it was missing, because we kind of went through it in his mission to Windermere. But, yeah, the other thing where they actually...
Look at the hole! Look at it!
It looks like a Marble Madness level. It's fucked.
It straight up does.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Oh, God. All right, we'll move away from Hayate. Let's discuss the big one.
Our sacred mother, Mirage.
Okay, so Mirage's hang up. I'll explain this and then we'll go into it. Because Mirage is the character that we mentioned before who you would be most benefited from having watched the previous Macrockers, because her ancestry is her hang up. The expectations, you know, or high expectations of, oh, your aunt was in Firebomber. Your grandparents were like the mayor and captain of the first big Macross ship. What was it, the Mega Road or something? I can't remember.
They were Max and Miria were like the, one of them was the mayor of the Macross 7, like the biggest city on the 7. And then also like in SDF, like, they kind of are the first humans and Trotty like couple
to
get together. Adorable, and get married. By the way, I really love that when referring to the old shows, they actually show characters with the old art style.
Yeah, I know. I know.
And they're fucking adorable.
It's great. I agree.
They have a knife fight that might be the most badly animated thing ever in the SDF TV show.
Well, thank God it was just still images, but okay. So Mirage, yep, people comment on it, not really so much in the later half of the show, but certainly it's mentioned a few times in the beginning, and it's certainly something that Mirage is very self-conscious of. She, you know, knows full well that she's a genius, or genius, however you pronounce it, and it's a weight on her. And I'll just come out and say this, because I feel I need to just spit it out of my system here. They didn't do jack shit with it. At least in my opinion. I think that they basically dropped this point around the midpoint of the show. And it's not because Mirage gets over it or deals with it or reconciles with it. It just is done. And the thing is, right, the way I described this to Doc in private message earlier was, imagine you are grading an essay from someone. The essay is meant to be 2,000 words long. That's the word count. And what the person submits to you is something that's 300 words long. It's just the opening paragraph, but the opening paragraph is really, really, really fucking good. You could recognize that if they continued from that, they would come up with something truly great if they met that word count that I mentioned. But they didn't. And that's what it feels like to me in Mirage. As a character who starts out, I really like it. I like her personality. I like the chemistry that she has with Hayate and the banter that they have. You know, that he's clearly, you know, the doesn't give a shit casual flyer, and she's all strict and serious, and I'm going to play by the rules. And, you know, that's a good setup. But they don't do anything with it. It's the chess match that is exactly one move long before they go off and do something else because they're bored.
You're representing my favorite character in a not-so-flattering way. I am calling the police right now. I will say she absolutely has a, like, good character arc. It's just that it's not as much in the forefront as it should be. Like, a lot of kind of her character arc kind of, and the issues that she goes through kind of get resolved or are left for the background, and you kind of see the result of her going through the stuff. Like, the resolution to the arc where she, to her character arc where she's like, oh, I'm flying by the book, I shouldn't do that, is basically just explained off screen. And then she, a couple of times, says, well, I'm gonna try flying better now. Okay.
Yep.
And like, man, so...
And then she reverts back to type.
Like, really, I think she definitely does have a lot of character. She has a lot of... She has a wonderful character arc. She has, like, a fair few, like, kind of very nice arcs revolving around both Hayate, both her legacy, and stuff. But, yeah... It's not given enough attention.
No, and she's able to support Hayate in some important ways in which Freya isn't. And she helps kind of bring them together. Like, I actually thought that, like, that would kind of be the final stage of her arc in some ways when she was like, okay, my two friends that I love and care about, they're getting together. So now I will protect them with everything that... But they didn't... It didn't feel like they were as intentional as they should have been. With that, it just conceptually she's incredible, but like they have all the pieces there. I feel like they might have just been relying too much on the fact that, you know, she's a genius, right? She comes from this line of Macross characters that people love, and so people will care about her. We don't really have to spend that much time with her. Oh, let's develop Mikumo some more.
I'm fine with developing Mikumo, my almost other favorite character.
I felt like, man, those scenes in the final, like, act, I just wanted more Mirage, and I kept getting, and Mikumo was great, it was cool. Like, I just, man, I wish they would have found a way to rearrange some stuff.
I wish, yeah, you know, there was a lot of kind of moments, I think, dedicated to... What was the fucker's name? What was the asshole? The dude with the glasses, Royd.
Royd?
There were a lot of scenes dedicated to kind of showing Royd kind of say the same things over and over. I would totally have, like, just dedicated those scenes to best person ever.
Our sacred mother, Mirage.
Here's the thing, right, from my perspective, like, because I like to be an arrogant arsehole and say, well, here's how it could have been done. So I'm going to be an insufferable prick for the next 2 minutes, so please bear with me on this. But I've had this on my mind literally since I first saw... Yeah, I know. Since I first saw the show for the very first time. Now, I swear blind this was something that was said or at least thought by Mirage. Doc says that he can't remember it. So people who have seen Delta, if this did happen and I'm not making up and having some sort of acid nightmare, please confirm in the chat, or the comments section, or on your favorite blog post, whatever. Send a carry pigeon to me, whatever way you want to tell me.
Okay, my hand is hovering above a big red button. Handle with care. Proceed.
Okay, I swear blind that Mirage said, or at least thought to herself at one point, that after Messer dies, it's on her to take on Keith and bring him down.
So I rewatched episode 11 to try to find it, and I admittedly watched it at higher speed, but I thought I caught all the subtitles, and I I saw, not episode 11, but 12 or whenever it is that she's promoted, and she's saying to Freya and Hayate, look, I have to prepare, but, like, I have to, like, step up my responsibility. But she never mentions, like, the White Knight or Keith by name that I saw.
Yeah, she mentions that she needs to kind of be the kind of team leader, kind of bring the team together, kind of take on the role. But it's Hayate that says, okay, I will, like, replace...
Oh, this fucking line made me laugh.
Yeah, I will replace Messer I'll do double in, like, the work. Firepower in the actual, like, combat potential.
Yeah, quantity-wise, you are still down one, and quality-wise, you are down significantly. This is like that... my reaction to that was from this fucking scene in Guardians of the Galaxy where Rocket Raccoon just goes...
That is the most real, authentic, hysterical laugh of my entire life, because that is not a plan.
It's barely a concept.
Because it's true.
I love that Captain Arad is just like, yeah, let's go with that
yeah.
play.
Yeah.
He's not
more
like,
money
listen,
for
kid,
jellyfish.
I respect
chips.
You.
He's just got the time
exactly. We don't have to pay another pilot.
Oh, yeah. Cuss it down, baby. Check that overhead.
The Jubilee's coming up. Gotta save the money.
Fucking hell. The reason I bring this up is because Vorg has already alluded to what I'm going to say, which is that I think that what the show should have done at this point was massively put the pressure on Mirage and not put it on Hayate, so that way it actually tests her. I mean, her introspection previously about how she felt burdened by her, you know, ancestry, that was in her head, but she always had at least, you know, Messer and all the others backing her up. Like, she wasn't at the forefront. She wasn't like, you know, the golden goose. But then she is... but not because it's Hayate who does all the work in the end. It should have been her that was slotted into the, you know, person who takes down Keith slot, not Hayate. And from there, you can then expand on that to do certain things. You can have Mirage working her ass off round the clock, you know, doing training, doing practice runs, drills, etc. Basically going nuts over how much she's fighting to, you know, get herself ready for the inevitable battle with, you know, Keith, Mr. White Knight himself. And that's when you could start bringing Hayate in, you know, someone she still has to babysit in battle a little bit, because she's the one who's still the most experienced, arguably, not when Hayate's getting away with his, you know, fucking synchronization bullshit. But what I'm saying is, you can then bring him in as the humanizing factor, you know, the mentor-mentee relationship that transitions romantically, because he's the one who makes her feel like a human being and reminds her, hey, look, you're working yourself too fucking hard here. Have her be tested. Have the actual, you know, thing that she fears, you know, she will fail at, be tested in the strongest terms possible. Don't give it to Hayate to deal with, because, well, it's not his character arc. It just feels like they find and replaced her name with his, with the key thing. That's what I would have
thought. Yeah, and then imagine, right? Hayate still takes Messer's, like, plane, and then the White Knight's like, holy fuck, like, you're not even worthy of him. And the White Knight's about to kill, like, Hayate in Messer's plane. And that kind of makes Frey actually kind of snap, kind of reconsider the experiences she had with Hayate, like, and kind of finally kind of break into the, like, free-form flying, like, when he's in danger. And that solidifies the relationship even more. Why didn't you write this show? Fuck.
And again, like I talked to, they sort of did have that moment when she caught him in Gerwok mode at the end of season 1, episode 13. I was like, well, she's done it. She's overcome her kind of mechanical, sort of duty-based flying. And she's going to embrace kind of freedom and love and that sort of. But no, it didn't quite work out that way. One of the things I did appreciate about our Sacred Mother is that she, like, was incredibly self-aware about how to deal with the problem she had, but in other people, like, Hayate's, all of his issues with his dad and his own kind of, man, like, can I even, like, authentically choose this path of being a pilot, knowing that my dad was a pilot? And she just is, like, easily, like, straight talks him, just like, you know, look, like, it's an authentic decision because you made it. Like, you came to this yourself independently. That's what's important, not the fact that your dad did it. And, like, she so sort of diagnoses that, but, like, in her own life, she has struggles dealing with it, you know, because she's the whole reason she's such a mechanical flyer is because she, like, despite being up from the family she was, she had to train and work incredibly hard to prove people wrong about her. And so she's, like, entirely by the book, such a type A, like,
I mean,
person.
Yeah, she got into being a pilot because of her legacy. And part of that arc is that she realizes that she likes it after kind of having to fly with Hayate. After Hayate kind of shaking up.
Yep.
Like, the... kind of thing she thought she didn't like, but she kind of had to do. I'm really sad.
Like, when the Heinz, like, asked why did they fly, why the fuck did Mirage should have been the one in the trial to answer that and deal with that problem. Because he asked Freya, why do you sing? And then it's like, why do you guys fly, Delta Platoon? And of course, and Hayate gets to talk, but it's like, no, like, this right here in particular, why do you fly? This is Mirage's deal.
Doc, the reason for that is because she's so by the book, so by the rules, that she'll not speak up when until spoken to in a court of law.
Oh.
I'm joking. Oh my God. I'm joking. That being said, you brought something that I hadn't even thought of. But the thing about Hayate as a pilot, right, I'm going to have to unfortunately start throwing in some Frontier comparisons here, which are going to make some fans angry, but fuck it, it has to be done. The show itself will compare itself to Priest Macross's by its very construction. So, I firstly like Hayate more than Alto, but...
not difficult, not a high bar. But Alto's okay. But
if there's one area in which I can't compare Hayate favorably to Alto, it's his actual skill as a pilot. Like, Alto actually trained, like, as a pilot prior to the show. Like, he's clearly done a lot of aeronautics, and then he's actually at school. Hayate's just goofing.
He made a lot of paper airplanes.
Hayate actually... the times he manages to beat Keith, or at least show he's better than him, is when he's getting the, you know, fucking channeled buff MMO style from Freya.
Yes.
Juice.
Which doesn't really sell his skill to me. And that's... And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I don't actually have a problem with that. If they'd have done something like have Mirage just suddenly start being jealous of that fact. Like, oh, look at this fucker. He comes in and suddenly he's flying all over the place like he's a man possessed, which is actually true. And I've studied for years how to be a pilot, and I just simply can't be as good as that. I don't have that kind of, you know, backing power for me, be it literally from the song or just a person. It ain't fucking fair, it ain't right. And then maybe have that be something to develop a character arc around, something that she overcomes. Because I would certainly be jealous of someone coming in who has this otherworldly ability to do the thing that I have worked hard to be good at. I mean, that would be very relatable.
I'm sad.
Also, like... Kaname is, like, my favorite character overall, but Mirage is the hottest what? Lady in the show.
Namikumo, easily. Yeah, I'm going there.
Mirage.
Is this why you like Mirage? I will kill you.
Me? No. I've been talking about the reasons I like Mirage, but no, but she's undeniably... best girl in terms of those criteria.
She's like, at least for me, she was the most, like, her conflicts were the most, like, relatable and kind of easy to kind of self-insert into. I think she, like, I don't know what I'm saying. I'm sad.
No, I hear you on that totally. I hear you totally for
man. And there was this like sort of inverse relationship with Hayate's development. You know, Hayate was aimless drifter, came to this planet, found a purpose, found people to latch onto, and goals and meaning and something to do, like something to live for and work at and focus on. And Mirage, of course, our sacred mother, like, she had that. She was hyper-focused. She had to learn from Hayate and, like, let go a little bit and kind of embrace his sort of kind of free spirit and flying for love, flying for enjoyment. And of course, it's the place they're in too, Ragna, which, like, helps get them both to this kind of happy medium, this, like, balanced area. But they both kind of have these inverse arcs getting balance in their life. And it was cool, but again, like, I just felt like they didn't quite stick the landing with it and really put it together in in an intentional way.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of potential there. It's just not, unfortunately, properly tapped.
Even so, right? Even so. Right at the end of the show, basically, both Freya and Myrage end up kind of confessing to Hayate. And, like, even then, with, like, basically the underdeveloped or, like, undershown, like, plot arcs and all that shit, like, you get an extremely, like, heartfelt and touching, like, confession from Mirage, while Freya is like, oh my god, you're so cool. It's like, oh my god.
Yeah. I actually, can I say the one thing that I think they actually did nail with Mirage, like, in the end game of the show? Like, I want to talk about the construction of love triangles later, but just to address something now, Mirage is the loser. That's unequivocally true. We can't deny that. But here's the thing. Her losing is... Bear with me on this.
It's a long
yes,
game.
Yes, Freya is going to die. Freya is going to die in, like, 20 years max.
Less than that.
Yes.
I would
probably
argue.
Less than that.
Much less.
And in the movies, it's going to be like, cut to 10 years later. You know it.
In the in Freya's funeral, Hayate and Mirage holding hands.
That's the first step.
Not even cut. The body's not even cold. Fucking hell. Oh man. Okay, but here's the thing, right? When I've said before numerous times on Warrior Death Show that I have two kinds of complaints. One of which is what we actually get is shit, and what we got was good, but I just wanted more of it. And I infinitely prefer the latter kind of complaint, because at least I can then say what we did get was good, as opposed to some of the crap that we've reviewed over time. So, when I say this, with all the stuff that I've said and all the stuff I'm going to say, that I am critical of Macross Delta, A, I still think it's a damn great show, and B, it is that latter kind of complaint where I just wanted more. It's the worst kind of, you know, thing to say, but it's also, like, you know, the kindest kind of criticism, in my opinion. So just keep that in mind, because there's still a lot of stuff I want to say about where I think they just didn't, unfortunately, do as much as they could have done.
It's 26 episodes, though. Like, there is at some point where, like, hey, I kind of wanted more of this, where it's like, okay, cool. Like, you kind of didn't focus on this on purpose, and it's not, like, an issue where, oh, if you had the space, you could have done more. It's like...
Yeah, I do think that they should have... If I were doing the show, like, there was some things I would cut in favor of allowing time for others. It's difficult with an ensemble cast, though, to be honest. Even Frontier did not manage this properly, I will confess, despite my love for it.
And it had fewer characters, way fewer.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned in an article that I wrote once about how they completely missed the best opportunity for, like, you know, a proper, like, you know, genuinely dramatic relationship arc between Mishiru and Clan. Like, they play off her being, you know, basically an infant, you know, underage child when she turns from her normal Zentradi form to that, as a joke, when they could have actually turned that into something truly heart-wrenching, you know, that they can't be a proper couple because of that. And then, of course, I also mentioned the fact that, you know, Alto is the rival to Brera Stern, who is the Keith of that show, when really it should have been Ozma, because that would have then been allowed, you know, a found family member versus a biological family member. What's the more relevant factor here? You know, we can have that debate. So even Frontier doesn't quite get with it, and I think it's just the fault of stuffing the show with too much. You know, too many plates being spun at once, which is a shame, but I still like what they did regardless. I just, again, would like more. Anyway, let's talk about Freya briefly. Now, you might not think there's much of a legacies and expectations thing here, but hold your asses here. There's two
hold
things specifically
asses?
With
what?
Her. Horse. We're not holding alien spaceships here, Vorg. Okay.
I thought you were, like, misquoting Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so and there's what to me feels like the cliff note, or even the single line, you know, concept of a subplot with Freya that gets dropped almost immediately when it even gets introduced. People start suspecting she's a spy for Windermere.
Oh my god. It gets dropped like an episode in.
They trust her.
Yes.
It's not even a question of what happens with the people, you know, suddenly U-turning on it. Freya could still have had, like, you know, some hang-ups from that, like, you know, and have it be reflective of her, like, you know, her identity as a person. Like, is she a country woman? Like, you know, does she have any idea? Like, is the Windermere that she loves still there? Like, or is it now gone because of what, you know, Hines, Royd, and the various, you know, Windermerian royalty are doing? Like, there's a lot that could be mined from that. And it actually kind of is maddening when Cheryl's alternate arc of her being a spy, a legitimate spy, mind you, but a spy nonetheless, got more screen time in a two-movie thing.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So that's unfortunate, because Freya does mention a lot of times that she loves Windermere, but I wish that they had actually had her define to others what her ideal version of Windermere is. I mean, how many times in real-life politics have you had people give different impressions of, you know, the countries they live in, the countries they admire? Hell, we still can't on fucking Twitter get an idea of Japan that isn't, like, you know, the most right-wing bullshit crap ever. So, you know, people can have perspectives on countries that they love and adore. That
I've
might
lived
not...
there, man!
Yeah. I was born in the prefecture and I've studied... Fuck off, like, cockstain. Anyway, so that to me, like, I wouldn't have even brought it up if they weren't going to do anything with it, but the fact they did just immediately, because I'm an OCD kind of guy for this stuff, was just like, this would be great if they did something with it, but no. So, however, we mentioned just a minute ago that Freya is going to die early because Shoji Kawamori gets it another stab in the back, like, you know, oh, the love triangle is concluded in a satisfactory way, but you're not going to like it.
I already like didn't like it.
Yeah, in the TV show.
No,
it's not quite a terminal illness, but it's basically a terminal illness.
But this is funny enough, actually, mentioning what happened to Cheryl. It's actually not too dissimilar to what happened to Freya. But I'm not going to go into the mechanics of why too deeply, other than to say that Windermerians, as we've said before, only live until an average of 30 years. Why? Because they are otherwise humanoid in every respect, so you'd think they'd live to a similar age as to regular humans. The reason is because of the runes they have, which are fold quartz that are naturally grows from their bodies and their hair specifically. By the way, how terrifying must it be to get a fucking haircut as a Windermerian? Holy shit.
Oh.
Not that, but how horrifying is it to have a thing on your head that shows other people your emotions, like, basically all the time?
Yeah. Society would evolve quite differently if that was the case.
Do you reckon there's a subset of Windermerians who have styled their runes after emojis? You've got one guy, like, who's the thinker, and he's got the thinking emoji, like the one that, like, stroking the chin. That is a horrifying thought. I'm so sorry.
That would be kind of incredible in a bad way.
Yeah, just this as a joke character, I would appreciate that, not as a serious person. Okay, so a lot of, like, some of the Windermerians, when we meet them first off, particularly the knights, they have a sickly white pallor on some of their skin, which is literally turning to dust. And while it's not outright stated, you can definitely infer what happens with Cassim, who's one of the other knights, actually one of the better sub-characters in the show, funnily enough. His little arc that he gets is quite satisfying, but we'll get to him later. When Windermerians use their runes, which is usually to have them, like, psychically communicate with each other and also to feel the wind, as they call it, heightened senses and so forth. I mean, it's fold quartz, it's the, you know...
Nitro boost.
Yeah, it's the nitro boost stuff. But... Windermerians using their runes causes them to age faster. So my theory is that they simply die earlier because the runes naturally shorten their lifespan, but they shorten it quicker by using it.
I didn't realize that it was like fold quartz, but maybe, yeah, it does kind of take over their body and turn it into quartz. Or, like, yeah, it's less that they die of natural causes, more that the thing actually kind of, like, replaces vital parts of their body with, like, garbage.
Yeah, it burns them out, essentially. So Freya, because she has been singing and her singing uses her rune, she, in, like, one of the penultimate episodes, suddenly develops a little white patch of this dead skin on her hand, on the back of her hand, specifically. And it develops a little bit more during the final battle, because she's burning herself out for all the singing that she's doing.
Some of that shit looks like The Fly, and it bothers me. It disturbs me.
Yeah. So, basically, her lifespan, because Windermerians live to an average of 30, and she's been, you know, guzzling through her rune like an SUV going through gas, I'd say she's probably got 2-4 years tops.
Probably not if she stops using her rune, which is kind of likely because the conflict is kind of over to some degree.
Wouldn't she still want to sing though?
Well, yes, but saying you don't have to use your rune to its fullest potential to affect a ton of people.
True.
I wonder if she can sing without using her rune. I think it always
glows when she starts singing. But yeah, cool. Which was, this kind of plot point is like, not the nail in the coffin, but it's like a child corpse also put in the coffin. Because it's like, okay, wow. It's like, cool. I think Freya is a cool character. and like, the resolution is best character doesn't end up in a good, like, resolution to her own, like, arcs. And she doesn't end up with a person that makes sense. B, the other character that we like is dying really soon.
Yeah. I have to say, though, Vaughn, like, it would have also left a bit of a sour taste in my mouth if Freya was the one who lost because of the fact that she is going to die quite
quickly.
No, what I wanted
was there should be no, like, love triangle to begin with. It's like, okay, Freya is basically a child, right? So she's kind of like, she kind of thinks, like, Hayate is cool. She kind of thinks, like, she's in love with him. But then ultimately kind of realizes that, oh, well, I mean, I'm basically being a child. And, you know, Hayate and best girl my age, you know, are really nice together. I'm really happy. She sees like the effect they both have on each other's life, and she's really happy for it, and she finds her own happiness somewhere else, in the garbage, for instance.
That
actually happened. You know what's maddening? That actually happened to Cheryl in Frontier, because she literally does go rooting through trash in a flashback.
Oh my god.
Oh, poor baby. I know.
I'm serious.
I know. Alto has to find her on the street.
I really like all of these characters. I don't like, it's not like, oh my god, this character is so bad. But really, they could have been done so much better. I'm so sad.
According to the wiki, Hayate is 17. Freya. Mirage, our sacred mother, is 18.
And Freya is 15.
Freya is 15.
Yeah, because it's her 15th birthday. They say it.
Right. So, like, would you still...
I mean, they're both underage, so...
Well, it's like not Mirage. Too big of a so difference. She'd go to jail.
Yeah, well, current Earth laws, but technically, like, for Wintermerians... Like
they're not part of that.
Yeah. No. I'm not saying they have different laws necessarily, but it's like that's basically halfway through their lifespan. Like the mayor already wanted
40-year-old.
Yeah, their mayor already wanted to marry her to someone from like years ago. Mm-hmm. So they probably have different education. So they teach like people differently, and they consider the age of maturity different. And probably different. So
yeah,
makes sense
for a 30-year-old lifespan. That's fine.
Yeah, I suppose it would. I don't know. I suppose it's legal if you consider Freya in dog years. There you go.
Yeah, I was just saying that sorry, to the point of I didn't consider her like a child. Like it didn't feel weird. Like what is this kid doing in the in the love triangle?
It felt like what is this kid is doing in the love triangle for me? Because her personality is like, I'm not saying it from like an age perspective, but her personality is really like a child. She really is just interested in Hayate because he's cool and stuff. So
that's true. He's so hot. He flies.
Well, I've just gone to one of the best web comics on the internet, which is XKCD. They actually have a formula to work out if it's creepy or not. So here we go. Standard creepiest rule for dating. It says here, don't date under, open bracket, age divided by 2 plus 7. Age being the person in question. So Hayate is 17. If we half that, that is 8.5. And then we add 7. That makes 14.5.
15.5, yeah. Oh my god.
Yeah, so
she's half a year too young.
Oh my god, it's like creepy. Not creepy. Oh my god, it's fine now.
Yeah. Depends if you want to round up or down, I suppose, but anyway.
Or don't round at all.
So anyway, why am I talking about this whole skin condition, you know, early death thing? And why is that relevant to legacies and expectations? Two reasons. First off, I'm a huge sucker, unfortunately, for plot points that involve some sort of physical scarring as a reminder of things that have happened. Freya's going to have to live with what she's gone through now as a literal reminder every time she looks at her hand. Like, that's going to remain with them.
Yeah, but so does every Windermerian ever.
Well, they some burnout. But this is actually the second point that you're alluding to. Here's the thing, right? The Windermerians make at least Royd and the Aerial Knights, and certainly Hinds, make a big deal of them being the inheritors of the proto-culture. Now, the proto-culture, as suggested, actually created the Windermerians and humans and the Ragnans and the Valdorians and all the other species. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but if they, you know, would not alternative interpretation be that the proto-culture actually shortchanged them by giving them this thing that artificially lengthens their lifespan? Or sorry, shortens, rather? Seems like a rum deal to me. And this ties into the better side of this theme, which is the interpretation of history, which we'll get to when we talk about the proto-culture as a whole. But that's why I like it as a plot point, because they also do make the fair point, which has been referenced numerous times, particularly with Cassim, that it's not a question of how long you live, but what you do with the time you have.
Yes.
Now, because Cassim in particular, like he mentions his son, you know, he specifically chooses not to kill Hayate in the end, and instead, well, maybe not kill Hayate, but he certainly doesn't want to dump his plane in the apple orchards. He doesn't want to leave behind that last image of him going so far to kill someone that it would ruin, you know, something he is quite fond of. I don't mind the idea of Freya, like, being fated to die quite early, relatively speaking.
Me neither.
I like it as presented. It's bittersweet. It stings, yes. It's not certainly not fair. But the fact is that she certainly doesn't die on screen. So it's one of those endings where you can imagine for yourself whatever makes you comfortable to reconcile that fact. Hayate even says we'll be together forever. I'm like, you know what? That's cool. And I must say, I really love the final image of them flying off together. I thought that was really sweet.
I was too busy crying because the show hurt me. I didn't like it. Moving on.
Can I ask you a question, Virgilia? Can I ask you a question? This might sting a little, but so you mentioned the final confession by Mirage at the end, you know, confessing her feelings to Hayate. Like, how did you feel about?
Would he fucking?
I was really unsure to feel about, like, the fact that it was basically in service of helping Freya do
yes.
it. She's just sort of like, hey, I'm putting myself out here.
Yes.
Where are you at, Freya? Come on, I'm trying to push you to do this thing that will save us all.
Hmm.
Like, it felt a little bit like, I don't know.
I felt really conflicted. Aside. That's exactly what it was. And it was really it sad.
I hear you on that. I mean, don't get me wrong, I think that it was a very mature thing for us to do, both of that and the earlier scene in which Mirage
pushes them together. She's too good for this show.
Yeah.
Exactly. She's always doing the mature thing. She never gets what she wants. God damn it, Shoji Kawamori.
All right, so let's now talk about Mikumo, because Mikumo, I would argue, is one of the other characters, apart from the big three, who gets the most development, even if it is very back-ended in the later half of the show. So, who is Mikumo? Because we alluded to the fact that she's free, but she's clearly not free because of the way she looks. She's the Dizzy of this show, if you happen to play Guilty Gear. So, first off, Mikumo is revealed initially to have been an artificially engineered life form. She's a clone, test tube baby, use whatever terms you wish, to essentially fill the gap for, not necessarily even for Wild Curry, but just to be a singer.
And we don't know this for a really long time.
No.
This is not touched on until, like, the last quarter or so.
Yeah, a lot of the development, as you said, not only comes at the end, but it also comes in, like, really short bursts. It's like her development is kind of like, okay, you're a robot now. Well, I guess I'm a robot now. And while she does kind of give quips about, like, the thing, oh, well, I'm the youngest member of the group and stuff, we never really get to see what effect this has on her. Like, she's definitely just putting on a facade. It's like, well, I'm strong, I'm going to keep singing, because that's what I do. But, like, we never really explore what, like, she feels about it. And then the later revelation that you're going to talk about just is also like, well, this thing. And she has no time to process it. And, like, the show basically ends after it. And it's like, yeah, it's not just, like, at the end of the show. It's also, like, basically rapid fire. Like, here's the thing that happens. Well, cool.
Mm.
And then at the end of the show, here's the thing that happens. Well, cool.
Yeah. There is a bit of obscure foreshadowing of the fact that Mikumo seems very spaced out. Like, when she deals with the ruins. Like, you get the idea that there's some sort of strange connection. But I defy anyone to ultimately come to the, you know, guess what the actual outcome is.
Yeah, I will argue, like, that her kind of mysterious kind of demeanor and how she, again, is, like, more well-attuned to the kind of powers they use and, like, has the kind of, like, mentor sort of role, even though she has her own way of doing it. I think that kind of lends itself well to establishing the character and making them a lot more vulnerable later on. But again, much like what they did with the best character ever, they didn't just do very much with this.
Yeah. So I'm going to say right off the bat, by the way, that I actually like the revelations about Mikumo for a reason that you might not expect, which is actually that it's quite good satire. Hear me out on this. She's a manufactured pop star in the most literal sense.
Right.
Nice.
Right. You know, I was wondering, like, all throughout the beginning of her sort of, you don't really know that she's a clone or artificial life form. She's just kind of this detached, like, just force of nature almost. Like, doesn't really talk to people except to, like, criticize them or, like, get them to sing better or whatever, and is otherwise sort of aloof. Like, I was like, well, is she some sort of embodiment of the, like, shitty nature of the idol industry? Like, you gotta be ready to sing on a moment's notice. You know what I mean? Like, get up, don't cry.
Yeah.
Like, push yourself. Or, like, if you screw up, you're fired. Or, we have no use for you if you can't perform today. Kind of, like, those are all lines she said. I was just like, god damn, like, no humanity. And it turns out, literally, that's true.
Yeah, there is a line that she says as well, where she says her diet was strictly regimented.
Right.
So there's that. That's about the end of it, but I don't mind that, like, because I don't want them going too heavy on the satire, because I think Macross would be shooting too many spitballs at itself if it started going all in on the, you know, well, the idol industry shit, because it did literally, in this case, we literally made one from a test tube.
There are people that, like, argue passionately and believe that the entirety of Macross 7 is satire of, like, the notion of the rock star.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I don't necessarily subscribe to it, but it's an interesting lens to view some of this stuff through.
I'd argue it's a fair criticism to make of the idol industry, because I've certainly read about stories about idols in Japan who weren't allowed to date fucking anyone. Period.
Oh yeah, that's very common.
And that's bullshit, in my opinion. Fuck that noise. Like, don't punish them for the attitudes of their audience who, you know, wouldn't otherwise pay attention if there wasn't the, you know, the token element of being single. Fuck that. So, okay, that's the small part of it, which I like, but what's the big reveal, you might wonder? Well, it turns out that Mikumo is not just any old artificial life form, she is a recreation in the very Jurassic Park Dino DNA way! No, really! I'm not fucking kidding! I swear fucking blind, if Royd had just been walking around with a fucking cane and a piece of amber on it, it would have been too much for me to handle.
Spared no expense.
Oh god, I'm just going to throw in the fucking Jeff Goldblum quote here, like, before you knew what you were doing, you packaged it, you products it, you sold it. Fucking
you were so preoccupied with whether or not you could. You didn't stop to think about whether or not you should.
Well, that really could sum up the writing process for this fucking show. okay.
And you're selling it, John. You're selling it. You're selling
it. Oh my god.
Okay. Mikumo is actually the reborn incarnation of the star singer, they say, but I'm more of the opinion that a star singer, because she wasn't, or maybe she was just literally.
She was the star singer because she's like a figure from the proto culture. I guess they had one, and she was big.
Yeah.
My memory, admittedly, is pretty vague on the ins and outs of this.
It doesn't really matter, like, whether she was...
It's like Star Singer DNA and some frog DNA. And it kind of just, it just works.
West African frogs are known to change sex when in a single-sex environment.
Oh, God.
Life found a way.
Life does find a way, actually. That's what happens to beat out Royd in the end. So, hey, there you go. It fits as well. Who is the Star Singer? The Star Singer is a protoculture priestess who essentially... The religious role is not really well defined, but it's not really important because it's kind of last minute. What in practical terms it means is that Royd, who is the true villain, after dressing Mikumo in bondage gear for some fucking reason, don't ask me why.
I dig it. I'm just fishing for a reaction.
It's good because, like, in one scene he's like, "I pledge my wings to you." Cut to next scene, he's leading her all tied up at knife point.
Does he take her out for a walk?
I'm serving you right after I totally hypnotize you and convert you to my way of thinking.
Honestly, there was some creepy shit going on there. I did not like the undertones going on between them two once he had her under his control. Because, as it turns out, Royd knows the fucking Konami code.
It's not even the Konami code. It's her name. She's like a worse Donnie Crane. Holy shit.
And through that, he's able to control her. And because he can control her, through the use of a protoculture device in which his runes link in with it, in the very USB kind of way. By the way, that's the evidence that I would posit that the Windermerians are semi-correct about being the true inheritors, because you certainly aren't going to see regular humans use the device Royd uses, the, you know, the epic gamer chair of manifest, you know, single consciousness.
Epic gamer chair.
Yeah.
That's good.
He uses her to essentially start melding everyone's consciousness together. It's kind of like Sephiroth on the live stream a little bit, I'd argue.
How dare you invoke the name Sephiroth in this podcast?
One winged angel, man. He's gonna merge everyone's consciousness together. Now, Royd is a whole different problem because he says that, you know, our lives are too short, we can live forever in this formless body. I really wish that had been more developed, but then we'd have the Verm situation from Franks. That's why I brought that up earlier. Then again, the Verm were also a completely token villain, so fuck them anyway.
I kind of assumed that was more developed because there's like post-credits like scenes, which I didn't watch until like the last few episodes. So I'm like, oh, like this kind of comes out of left field. Maybe they have like kind of developed it. But no, apparently they haven't.
Not really. Not really.
No.
No, I mean, you can kind of, again, like with in the case of Mikumo being a clone, you can see that he's up to something.
Like,
I mean, I don't think you ever meant to, like, you don't think you're meant to ever trust Royd? Like, you know he's hiding stuff and has his own sort of agenda. You just don't really know what exactly he has in mind until, like, the very end.
This is true. Back to Mikumo, though, right? So, yes. Turns out she's the Star Singer, the reincarnation of a protoculture priestess. She, above anyone else in this show, and indeed anyone else in the Macross franchise as a whole, I would argue, is the true inheritor of the protoculture's legacy. So, here's my beef with this. I really, really wish this had been something that was revealed earlier in the show. Not massively early, but earlier, so we could have, again, got the kind of character introspection on this that this demands, which is, what does Mikumo think of this? She kind of writes it all off, but the Star Singer revelation, as Vorg very rightly pointed out, is given to her while she's under mind control, and after she is freed, there is no debriefing, quote-unquote, in which that can be discussed. They could have still fit in, like, a very brief scene in which she tells, like, Kaname says, like, oh, I know you're the Star Singer, and she could go, no, actually, I'm Mikumo Gaimda. Two lines would have done it. There you go. To reject this, you know, legacy that's been frosted.
There kind of was something, but not really.
Not really, no.
It really was just like a second in episode 22. And I'll talk about that when we are talking about other themes.
Yeah. So I kind of thought to myself, wait a minute. Okay, what's going on here? Because call me crazy here. Call me absolutely bonkers, but I'm going to make 2 points about Mikumo. First off, while I do like her character overall in the end, with the token development she got, I literally think you could have replaced her with a CD from the protoculture or some other similar, you know, MacGuffin, because that's what she gets reduced to in the end.
How dare you? How exactly. Dare you.
However, hear me out. Now, I know why they didn't do this, because it would make it too much like Frontier. But I genuinely get the impression that at some point they might have even pitched Mikumo as possibly a love interest for Hayate to replace Mirage, or to be the other one replacing Freya.
How much more can you replace Mirage? Oh my god.
But it turned out Mikumo, in a roundabout sort of way, is Hayate's sister.
Hayate's secret sister that he remembered as a dog.
Because it's his dad that, you know, is basically the father of this clone. Because he found the DNA and turned it into the lab and everything.
Man.
He made her, as you know. So, yeah, in a way, they're sort of siblings.
Yeah. The reason I say this is because if Freya occupies the Ranker role, then Mikumo absolutely occupies the Cheryl one. And they kind of have a, like, mentorish kind of thing in which she's a complete bitch.
Yeah, they, like, they totally split Cheryl into, like, these other two, into Mirage and Mikumo.
Yeah.
Not well, because Cheryl's not a pilot or anything, but I just mean in terms of, like, in terms of the, like, the zero-sum, like, pie of character development.
Yeah. So, I know why Mikumo ultimately wasn't love interest. I'm actually very grateful for that, because as I actually said to you, Doc, in the cast we did for Gwyn, I want to see female characters who are in the love triangle who are not just singers. I want to see them do shit.
Oh, hey. Did you watch Macross Delta? That was a pretty good one where there's not a singer and she's in the love triangle.
I'll bite my tongue to that.
Yeah, I think, like, yeah. I think, yeah, the way she was kind of portrayed as, like, the kind of cold mentor, again, like, the kind of sort of more mysterious person, yeah, it wouldn't really lend itself very well to being part of the romance unless they kind of sacrificed a lot of characterization given to other characters to give it to her and then actually turn her into a character. Mm-hmm. Which she is, but she's not the kind of character that works in that kind of scenario.
It's the catch-22. The thing about Frontier is that, like, this is just simply a function of quantity of characters, and this is not in any way slicing Wild Curry, because I think they're fantastic, even with the flaws we discussed at length here. I would not take away any of them. But you simply cannot... It's not functionally possible in a script to ultimately devote the same amount of time to all of the individual members of Valkyrie as you could do with a single character. Cheryl being the singer solo was for efficient storytelling more as much as it was for anything else. You didn't have to, you know, worry about characterizing, say, her backing keyboard player or whoever, you know. So it's one of those things where I really like Valkyrie, but at the same time, the fact that there is that many characters is kind of a force of nature thing in the writing department that works against it.
Don't blame Valkyrie, blame the Windermereans for existing.
The Windermereans actually get some of the best scenes in the show.
Yes, they get some of the best characterization for villains, and it's pretty good.
Where is my Kaname Buccaneer side story manga? That's what I want.
Yeah, where's the prequel of her being an idol? That would be something I'd watch.
I need it.
Like, even with just basically an entire episode kind of dedicated to explaining the backstory of Mrs. Buccaneer, and then, like, the kind of the band of misfits on their way to end up being the Valkyrie group. Like, it would have been pretty incredible if even, like, they sacrificed one other episode to do this for, like, I don't know, Mikumo, or to do this for, like, some other character that was underdeveloped, or to explore some other stuff in a similar sense. Like, you mentioned that, yeah, you know, we need time to develop the characters, and I mentioned that also, but I think, like, they could have done so much more, even with that little time.
I agree.
Because, yeah, like, for a basically half an episode kind of recap of the story of the group, it did so much to characterize, like, some of the less kind of prominent characters.
Call me mad here, but if I were to do this differently, I would have actually cut down Delta Flight simply to Mirage, Messer, and Hayate, and the Aerial Knights to Keith and Boak, and Cassim. Get rid of the others entirely.
No Royd? Oh wait, no, he's not a knight.
No, get rid of the others entirely. Cut it down to the bones here. Keep it very one-on-one and very personal. And that way you can end
the cool old guy.
Yeah, I think you're cutting off, like, if you start cutting off these kinds of characters, you're cutting off a significant part of the group dynamic that makes it feel, like, more real and kind of balances out it out as a group.
Yeah.
Like, the old dude didn't get any backstory. And, like, you know, you get, like, kind of just mentioned, say, master, whatever, I'm not your master anymore. And you kind of get those kind of quips that do reveal some of the story. But he doesn't get a significant, like, kind of backstory reveal, or he doesn't kind of get his, like, own character arcs, but he still contributes to the group dynamic from his, by, like, just who he is, his character.
Yeah, that admittedly is true. It's not a clean win, and that's the thing I think about with Delta in general, is that while, first off, just to reiterate folks who are listening at home, we still love this show. We only say these things because we love it and we want more. We want more from these characters.
Oh my god. Yes.
But two,
we've just been talking shit this entire time.
Yeah.
And this is like one of my favorite things that I've watched, like, ever. If this show hadn't made me cry for 2 hours, if this show had, it, like, didn't make me sad, like, right now, just thinking about stuff, I wouldn't have cared this much.
Delta, 10 out of 10. Yeah. Don't at me.
Yeah.
Get blocked.
Like we said with our favorite scenes, like, you know, it's just that it could have been even better. This to you, Doc, just to get ahead of ourselves here, is why I told you that I think that Delta could have eclipsed Frontier with ease.
The pieces are there.
Yeah.
They definitely are. Can I say something about Mikuma before
yes.
we move on from Mikuma? So there was a part after she's under the control of Royd near the end where you sort of see her but from the back, and Mikuma has most hair, so for a minute I couldn't tell it was her. I thought, this is a purple onion sitting on the screen. Why is this onion here? And I ask you, Shadon, could a CD accomplish that? Could a CD make me think, why is an onion on the screen? The answer to that is no.
No, it really, you're
no,
right.
It could not.
They have cell phones that look like, I don't know, like gelatinous cats. Maybe the Windermerian population has CD players that look like weird onions. I would not.
I guess it's
like,
possible.
It's entirely plausible. But really, I don't subscribe to the like idea that, hey, Mikuma could be replaced by a CD. No. She, again, contributes quite a lot to the group, by who she is. She's just underdeveloped.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair. That is absolutely fair.
There's a nice, you know, I talked about Mirage and Hayate having kind of parallel or inverse arcs. There's a neat moment between Hayate and Freya when they're both feeling like, you know, God, my teacher, mentor is only giving me shit. What the fuck? And those are really nice scenes, like comrades, colleagues, like saying, like, you know, fuck the boss, you know what I mean? Like,
fuck the power.
Screw that
guy. Hack the planet.
Like, and we'll show them tomorrow, like, I'm gonna sing my ass off and Mikuma will love me, and I'm gonna fly loops around Messer. And it's really nice. I like that.
Yeah, I agree.
And if there was no Mikuma being an ice queen, then you wouldn't have that either.
No. Oh, before I forget, one final thing to say about Mikuma is there's a scene that happens after the revelation of, you know, her history, not the Star Singer stuff, the actual, just the fact she's an artificial life form, where she speaks to Hayate on the observation deck. And I swear blind on my soul and my, well, what little of it there is, that I really swear blind that whoever was writing that legitimately wanted to write the show as with Mikuma as the love interest. It felt like a scene from a different version of Delta where she was that, because they were talking like they never really interacted ever prior to that. It was a good scene, don't get me wrong. And she's saying, well, you need to protect me out, you know, please protect me out there and all that. And they have a little banter and all that. I swear blind, that feels like a scene from a different version of Delta, an alternate universe.
I will kind of agree, actually.
You know who the get the guest writer for that episode was the owner and creator of macross.dojins.biz.
Oh, that's a lie. That web address is too straight-laced. You know it wouldn't be that easy. It would be something like God, Deculture Cloud or something. I don't fucking know. Ah, man.
Maybe.
Remember that part in the fan subs where they talk about the dick culture?
Oh,
maybe,
man.
Maybe it was Blazemaster 6.
Oh, fuck, yeah. Blazemaster did it.
Oh.
No, Mikumo's the real
And they drank.
Mikumo
has some tequila.
Mikumo is underage because she's free, but she still gets hammered on tequila.
And she does things that Valkyrie members never do. Do not do.
It's okay,
yes,
if it's with hoes.
She goes back into the quarters of the entire group. In the room, she finds hoes everywhere. Well, I mean, if she drinks tequila... Yeah, she drinks tequila, she can do crazy shit and have sex with girls. And if that's not, like, the ideal life, I don't know what that is.
Macross the Dojo's up is.
So, on that particularly sordid note, we will take another break here. We'll be back with discussing the other characters and the wider themes. World building in particular, communication. We're going to throw in everyone's favourite political term, globalisation, because that's a fucking thing in this, who would have thought. The Windermerians as villains, then how sympathetic they are, surprisingly enough. And we're going to talk about the music, the mechs. There's still plenty to stay tuned for, so don't miss it. We'll be back right after the break. Hello everyone, so as you probably guessed from the length of the podcast, this is not going to be a 30 second long break with a witty insert or some appropriate music clip that hopefully will get through YouTube's copyright filters, maybe. But instead we will be returning in the new year with part 2 of this podcast, in which we'll be covering the remaining characters and some other elements of the show. But from myself, from Doc, from Vargelia, if you've been listening to us via podcast, via guest appearances, or via the live stream that we've been doing, thank you all so much for joining us throughout 2018. It's truly been a delight having you all along with us as we've gone through this. But until next year, for right now, have a very Merry Christmas, a very Happy New Year, and we'll see you then.